The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
That's right.
Well,
good.
Okay. Good morning. I am not Claudio Grossman. I'm Bob Goldman. I teach here. Dean Grossman informed me last night that he has to attend certain meetings concerning, not to put too fine a point on it, the current unpleasantness on the campus. So he sends his regrets. He's going to try to be with us later on today. I'm sure he'll be well fed at the meeting. But as a professor who has taught for many years here in the area of humanitarian law, I am just delighted that the ICRC asked us to be the venue in the United States to co-host this launching of the customary international law study, which took so many years and has made a contribution, obviously, to our understanding of this important area of law. I should note that beginning in about 1983, because of the leadership of our then dean, Thomas Bergenthal, and the late Wally Solf, who was my mentor in this field, we began a fruitful collaboration with the International Committee of the Red Cross and indeed with the American Red Cross by holding at least, I think, five seminars, conferences for diplomats and others on international law. And indeed, there was a historic one in 1987 that dealt with an exploration, for instance, of the customary status of certain rules that were contained in Additional Protocol 1. And some of the usual suspects who are with us today, most particularly Mike Matheson and Buzz Carnahan and Hayes Parks, attended that, and here we are again today. And I think this is going to be a terrific conference. It's going to be very useful for our students and for others who are interested in this extremely important area of law. Now, I'd like to introduce Jeff Lone, who is the head of delegation of the ICRC's regional delegation for North America, stationed here in Sin City, to be able to say a few words of welcome also.
Professor Goldman and colleagues, friends, first of all, on behalf of the International Committee of the Red Cross, I'd like to welcome everybody here today. I think it's an important occasion, and we are indeed particularly grateful to the Washington College of Law for the opportunity to present this study on customary humanitarian law and to have a wider discussion on the relevance of the customary law in contemporary armed conflicts. It's an issue that is always topical, of course, for the ICRC. It's the basis and the backbone of our own operational work, and therefore we encourage and we are motivated by the depth of discussion that can take place on how law is adapted and works in relation to ongoing conflict. As you all know, customary international law is one of the sources of international law, including international humanitarian law. And this study that I think everybody hopefully has been able to see, and there are certainly copies outside, has been based on extensive research and is what we consider to be customary today. The mandate and the job of the ICRC was to try and to clarify the content of customary international humanitarian law, and it has taken this task very seriously and has spent 8 years on research and consultation to produce this study, and this research and consultation took place around the world with many eminent personalities legal advisors, historians, military experts, who all contributed and who all made suggestions. It is certainly the most comprehensive and thorough study of its kind. The study should not be seen, however, as the final word on custom, although we do think that it constitutes an important tool to the attention of state officials, judges, lawyers, and academics, and indeed those who are engaged and working on law and armed conflict. The study is also not an end in itself, but rather a starting point for discussions on the implementation, clarification, and development of humanitarian law. This is a moving, as always, process and something that grows and develops all the time. And I think the ICRC joins you here in looking forward to the discussions that will take place at this important conference and the input and the enrichment that these discussions can bring to our knowledge of the subject, our understanding of the subject, and indeed its own development. So with those few words, once again, thank you very much for your presence and for joining, and we all look forward to an active discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we begin the first panel, I just wanted to emphasize we do have these copies that are made available free of charge by the generosity, really, of Cambridge University Press and the International Committee of the Red Cross. So please do get copies of these. Those of you who are earning your salaries in euros or will be able to get an order form to get the three-volume set of hard copies, and we have a very we have some order forms there. It's a very useful, as well as other information for you. Hadar and Jean-Marie, will you come forward? Because Claudio is not going to be here today, Hadar Harris, who's executive director of our Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law, will chair the first panel. Okay.
I relish the moments when I get to substitute for the dean, but don't tell him that. Before we get started with the first panel, I just also wanted to make a reminder for anybody who has a cell phone to please turn it off or to turn it to silent. We're very pleased, as Bob said, to be hosting this conference today with the ICRC. We're also co-hosting with the War Crimes Research Office, and Susanna Sokoto, the executive director, is sitting just over here. So the first panel, we're privileged to have Dr. Jean-Marie Hankartz, legal advisor to the ICRC, speaking about the report overall. Dr. Hankartz is legal advisor in the legal division of the ICRC. His work focuses on the study of customary norms of international humanitarian law and on the protection of cultural property and the environment in times of armed conflict. He has a Bachelor of Laws from a university that I will mispronounce horribly in Brussels, so I won't even try. A Master's of Law from an unnamed university down the street here in Washington, D.C., but he said to me that his greatest regret was not to get his Master's of Law here at American University, which he can correct if he chooses to. Actually, his LLM, I'm sorry, was from the University of Georgia School of Law, and then his SJD was from George Washington University down the street. We're privileged to have him here today. He's the primary author, together with Louise Doswald Beck, of the report, and he's going to give us an outline and an overview of the three-volume set. So without further ado.
Thank you, Hadar. Good morning, everyone. Is this the microphone?
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, okay. Good morning. It's, of course, a pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful to be able to present to you an outline of the study, to talk a little bit about the background and also, obviously, about the methodology. It needs no repeating, of course, as you see on the screen, that the main sources of international law, as has already been mentioned, are treaty law and customary international law. I just wanted to underline here the definition of custom As stated in the statute of the International Court of Justice, custom is a general practice accepted as law, and we will obviously come back to these two elements. Now, with respect to treaty law, I just give here a small overview, short overview, of the main treaties of humanitarian law. There are some that are universally ratified. The Geneva Conventions, 1949, as you may know, have been ratified by all states and so are binding as a matter of treaty law on all governments. But there are also some that are not universally ratified, in particular the additional protocols of 1977, the Hague Conventions, in particular those dealing with cultural property, and then a number of weapons conventions. So obviously the focus of the study was really on the latter one, the subjects dealt with in those treaties that haven't been universally ratified, as it was felt that it was less pressing to determine whether the content of the Geneva Conventions was customary, since they are binding anyway as a matter of treaty law. So what are some of the impediments to the application of this treaty law, and which led to the mandate given to the ICRC to try and clarify or assist in the clarification of the content of customary IHL? First of all, as I just indicated, treaties are not universally ratified, a number of them at least, so this excludes the Geneva Conventions. Secondly, and very importantly, the content of that treaty law is not particularly detailed with respect to non-international armed conflicts, whereas those conflicts make up a majority of armed conflicts today. And thirdly, this treaty law requires you to characterize the conflict prior to be able to determine which treaty applies. So in order to know whether it's only common Article 3 to the Geneva Conventions or the entire body of law, you have to determine what conflict you're in order to determine whether it's Protocol 1 that applies or Protocol 2. You have to, again, determine whether it's an international or non-international conflict. And that obviously sometimes is difficult to do. You may think of the situation in the former Yugoslavia or today conflicts in the Congo. And I think it was against the background in particular of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia that in 1995 the International Conference of the Red Cross and Red Crescent mandated the ICRC to undertake this study. So what are then some of the key characteristics of this study, which was in a sort, in a way, meant to try and provide some answers or to try to overcome some of those impediments to the application of international treaty law? The first one, as has already been mentioned, and I just wanted to spell it out for you here, is the mandate given by the international community to undertake this study. This was done at the 26th International Conference of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, and for those of you who are not familiar with these conferences, they do include all states parties to the Geneva Convention, so it's really a conference at which states are also present. And this conference invited the ICRC to prepare, as you can see on the slide, with the assistance of experts in IHL representing various geographical regions and different legal systems, and in consultation with experts from governments and international organizations, a report on customary rules of IHL applicable in both international and non-international armed conflicts, and to circulate the report to states and competent international bodies. And we took that last bit of sentence very literal, and we circulated, we sent literally a copy of the three volumes to every government, to every national society, to every national IHL committee, and to every competent international body, international tribunals, organizations, and so on and so forth. So it was really, I think it's important to understand this mandate. It's obviously, as Jeff mentioned, the study is not the last word on custom, and it was really an invitation for the ICRC to try and help states to clarify what the content is of customary international law, which obviously is a body of law that is out there, it exists, but there's always room for dispute exactly what its content is. Secondly, this study was not undertaken just by two people, as you might wrongly think from these introductions. There was a widespread consultation carried out, and many people really have been involved, more than 200 if you count it all up. So there was a 12-member steering committee, as you can see here, which oversaw the work and which helped in the assessment of the content of custom. State practice was primarily gleaned, in a first instance at least, through reports on national state practice. About 50 such reports were prepared around the world, 10 in Europe, 10 in the Middle East, 10 in Africa, 10 in Asia, and about 10 also in the Americas. So we try to be as representative and widespread as possible. In addition, 6 reports were prepared on practice, state practice, coming from international bodies, from international fora. In addition, we ourselves in the ICRC looked into our archives and studied some 40 recent conflicts to see what additional practice we could glean from that, and also to try and cover some areas or some conflicts that hadn't been covered yet. And finally then, we held 2 rounds of consultations with about 35 governmental and academic experts. So together with the steering committee, we had meetings with these experts, and then we also consulted in writing on the final version of the study. And the third key characteristic, I believe, is the inductive methodology of the study. What you have here in front of you is volume 1 of the study, but you should not forget that this volume 1 is in reality based on the practice contained in volume 2. So volume 2, although it's volume 2, in reality came first. We did not finalize volume 1 before we had finalized volume 2. Volume 2 contains some 4,500 pages of state practice. Admittedly, there are some elements in volume 2 which are not state practice. There are some references to reports of UN experts and so on, which obviously do not constitute state practice in the pure sense. They are expert opinion. But we thought nevertheless it useful to leave it in to also show or give the interpretations given to certain rules by these experts. So we took this mandate very seriously, and that's indeed, as Jeff said, why it took 8 years to finalize this study, because we did not want to dream up or present a wish list of rules that we wish to be customary based on our feelings of what ought to be customary or what should be customary. But we really looked into the practice. We've done our homework, as Jeff said, as has never been done before, I have to say, and collected practice from around the world, and on that basis assessed the content of customary international law. Now, a little bit more about this inductive methodology. As I started out by saying, the custom is a general practice accepted as law. When we talk about practice here, if you look into volume 2, you see many references to military manuals, legislation, case law, official statements, reservations made upon ratification of treaties, reports on military operations, such as the report presented by the Pentagon to the Congress on the First Gulf War, operations during the First Gulf War. These are sort of the practices that you look at to assess custom. And you may say now, but this is not really practice, because these are what you may call verbal acts. These are words. This is not practice. And I would submit, of course, that yes, they're verbal acts, but behind them is really a lot of practice, because when the military manual provides that civilians mustn't be attacked or that this or that weapon mustn't be used, then in reality that's what armed forces are trained to do, and that's what they end up most of the time doing. And of course, that practice, when a soldier or when a operation decided not to attack a civilian object, that is difficult to present as such, that instance where that decision is made. But that decision is really based on that military manual, on that legislation, on that case law that has condemned people for attacking civilian objects. So these documents really also reflect a huge amount of practice. And what in reality, of course, often we look at and what we talk about most of the time are the violations. And I'll come to that in a minute. Now, a general practice accepted as law, obviously, practice in itself doesn't suffice, because there are many practices which are general, such as states sending letters of condolences when a head of state dies, but no one would say that this is a legal obligation, because it happens all the time that it must happen. So that's why it is required also that these practices are seen as legally required or legally obligatory, mandatory. Now, some explain this by saying So through their practice, states must consent to be bound by a practice, and others explain this element of opinio iuris as a belief that what is done is legally correct, is legally required. And both of these theories, of course, have their weaknesses and have their can be criticized. If you say that states must consent, then of course for many rules there are a large number of states which have never consented because they've never said anything. And so then people who follow this theory say that, well, they have acquiesced in the practice, so they've silently agreed to it, so that's a way to get out of it. If you say it must be based on a belief by the state, then of course you can't know what a state thinks, you can't know what it believes, you can only know what it says it believes. So you have to look again at what is in these military manuals, in that legislation, in the case law. So through this practice also transpires this this belief that what is done, what is regularly done, consistently, extensively, by a large number of states, becomes really the rule, becomes the guideline for conduct for all states. Because what is done by so many extensively and repeatedly cannot be something that would damage the interests of other states who haven't maybe expressed themselves on a particular issue because they weren't specifically interested or affected. Of course, I leave aside here a whole debate about whether it is possible and how this can be done to persistently object to the emergence of a customary rule binding for a particular state. I'm just making a general statement here. Now, as I said, these documents, this what is called practice, also reflects a large amount of practice, really battlefield practice behind it. And what we focus on most of the time, what we talk about most of the time, of course, is contrary practice violations through which, once again, these rules are more often than not confirmed. You see here a quote from the Nicaragua case in which the court had to decide whether the principle of non-intervention in the domestic affairs of other states was customary, notwithstanding the fact that there had been such interventions and that this rule had been violated. So the court said that it doesn't consider that for a rule to be established as customary, the corresponding practice must be in absolute rigorous conformity with the rule. The court deems it sufficient that the conduct of states should, in general, be consistent with such rules, and that instances of state conduct inconsistent with a given rule should generally have been treated as breaches of that rule, not as indications of the recognition of a new rule. It is in this respect also that it is very important to point out at case law where people have been convicted for violations, also to resolutions of international bodies where they condemn certain acts, because these condemnations show that these practices are seen as violations of existing rules and not accepted as practices aimed at establishing or able to establish new rules. Now, what is the content of the study on customary international humanitarian law? There are 44 chapters in this study, spread over six parts, dealing with a large number of issues. As you can see here, principle of distinction, specifically protected persons and objects, such as journalists, peacekeeping forces, specific methods of warfare, including starvation, denial of quarter, weapons, treatment of civilians and persons hors de combat, and finally implementation. Of course, this is not at all, these 44 chapters are not comprehensive. In other words, the study does not cover each and every subject of the law of war. For example, it has been said that there is no introductory chapter on the general principles underlying IHL. I think that's a fair point, and that's something that we can keep in mind for possible future updates. There is no chapter on identification. There is no chapter, it can be remarked, also on occupation. This is inspired more by the fact that as we assumed, or as we started from the consideration that the Geneva Conventions are ratified universally, and as the Hague regulations dealing with occupation were already seen to be customary by the Nuremberg tribunals, we didn't feel compelled to study in particular the subject of occupation. So the study is vast, but it's not exhaustive. Excuse me, these 44 chapters are both to be found in volumes 1 and volume 2. So in volume 2 you will have a chapter, if we take the first one, principle of distinction, distinction between civilians and combatants, you have a chapter in Volume 2 containing practice, manuals, legislation, and so on that subject. And then in Chapter 1, you have also a chapter on principle of distinction between combatants and civilians containing the rules that we found to be customary on the basis of that practice. So in Volume 1, then, we have come up with about 161 rules. This, of course, was not a preset figure. We started out looking at the raw materials as it was, looking at the subject matters, and worked our way up through to formulating these rules, and we ended up with 161, as I said, not at all exhaustive. And I would submit that if any other two people had done the study, they would come up on the basis of this material with a roughly similar number. Maybe some of the rules would have been formulated slightly differently, but by and large, I submit that the majority of these rules, if not all, would be found back somewhere. So of these 161 rules, this is just a very rough overview now, 12 of them are applicable in international armed conflicts only, and these deal mostly with occupied territory. There are a few rules on occupied territory, I have to say, with respect to cultural property in particular. Dealing with combatant status and prisoner of war entitlement. There are two rules that are only applicable in non-international. They deal with the issue of amnesty at the end of a conflict and the prohibition of reprisals in such conflicts. But the majority of the rules, as you can see, are applicable in any armed conflict, 147 of the rules. Now, if I just may pick a few issues to give you just a taste of what is in Volume 1 and what the rules look like and where they come from and how they are formulated and how they were assessed and what their relationship is with treaty law. If we take the prohibition of attacks against civilians, this is to be found admittedly already in the Hague Regulations, in the Geneva Conventions, but more clearly so in Protocols 1 and 2, and was also, excuse me, found to be customary in both international and non-international conflicts. With respect to the prohibition of attacks against civilian objects, on the other hand, as you may know, this is not to be found in Protocol 2, and yet on the basis of practice, we found this to be customary. So here, customary law, this is an example of where it goes further. It contains a definition of military objectives, it prohibits attacks against civilian objects, it prohibits indiscriminate attacks, all sorts of issues which haven't been regulated in treaty law explicitly in treaty law, in particular in Protocol 2. Some of these were covered, I think, in the ICC statute. Another example that I picked out is attacks against works and installations containing dangerous forces. Excuse me, I have to step back to also mention that these rules on such fundamental rules as attacks against civilian objects, indiscriminate attacks, they're very much similarly formulated in the study as in treaty law. Now, and I contrast this with the next rule or the next subject, works and installations containing dangerous forces, a very special subject within the protection of civilian objects. These objects, these installations, and these are dams, dikes, and nuclear power plants, obviously may not be attacked if they're civilian objects, but the issue comes up when they are military objectives, may they be attacked. And Protocol 1 has set out a very detailed, extensive rule on that, very complicated rule, I have to say. And we saw from the practice that this rule as such, with all its details and all its commas, hasn't been accepted by a number of states, and so it doesn't represent customary international law. Yet on the other hand, through statements and reservations made, we also did see that states had a clear concern for these for attacks against such works and installations and did not consider them to be any odd military objective that can be attacked as such without really careful, necessary, feasible precautions. So we formulated a rule on this subject that summarizes a number of considerations and that is not as such to be found in treaty law. And the third example, protection of peacekeeping forces, is not as such contained in Protocols 1 or 2. It wasn't dealt with. It really became an important issue in the 1990s and culminated in the recognition of such attacks against such peacekeeping forces as a war crime in the ICC statute. So we also found this rule to be customary, but it's, let's say, of more recent vintage. As I said, the study is not comprehensive. It doesn't deal with all the issues, and obviously it also doesn't answer all questions. Quite on the contrary, it also exposes some areas where clearly clarification is required. A first example, if we remain in the area of conduct of hostilities, is the definition of civilians in non-international conflict. This hasn't been clarified in practice, and it hasn't been clarified in treaty law, even though it's said in several treaties that civilians may not be the object of attack. There is no definition exactly of who is comprised within this category of civilians. In particular, the question is there whether members of armed opposition groups, rebel forces, whether they are civilians who lose their protection against attack because they take a direct part in hostilities, maybe all the time because of their membership in that group, or whether they are some sort of armed forces, some kind of combatants, obviously not with entitlement to prisoner of war status, but not civilians. So that hasn't been clarified. Then, as I already mentioned, the term direct participation in hostilities, the content of this concept hasn't been clarified, even though it's so important for the protection of civilians. Civilians lose their protection if and when they take a direct part in hostilities, but when that is, the temporal scope of that direct participation and exactly what acts constitute direct participation, we realized early on from the study that there were various examples given, lists of acts that were covered, but there was not sort of unanimity of view. And because of this, as some of you in this room know, we have started a process of expert consultations in 2003 to try and clarify the concept of direct participation in hostilities. Another issue mentioned in the study as not being clear is how to qualify a person in case of doubt. As you may know, Protocol 1 has offered a possible answer, namely in case of doubt, a person is considered to be a civilian, but this is not universally accepted, and so we did not find this rule to be customary. But nevertheless, the issue still exists, and as I say here, requires further clarification as to exactly what it means and how it's supposed to be implemented. If I may venture into some issues on weapons, I'm not a weapons expert, I have to say, but just to give you a few other examples of rules, how they relate to treaty law, how they've been formulated. Exploding bullets, these have been outlawed by the St. Petersburg Declaration, exploding bullets under 400 grams. But practice has shown since a long time that in fact such bullets have been introduced weighing less than 400 grams, and there have been no objections. So actually the rule in custom that has developed is slightly different from the treaty rule, and so if you see the rule as we formulated it, it's the anti-personal use of such bullets that is prohibited, but the anti-material use is now accepted. The second example would be landmines. As you know, there is a ban on anti-personal landmines contained in a treaty that is not universally ratified, and obviously there is official contrary practice to the effect that such landmines are legal, and so we did not find this ban to be customary. With respect to specific restrictions on the use of both anti-personal and anti-vehicle landmines, as you may know, there are a number of detailed provisions in two protocols to the CCW, Protocol 2, and an amended Protocol 2. And we did not, again, find all these detailed rules to be customary, but yet we did see that there were concerns for the way landmines are used, and so we did have a general rule saying that all steps must be taken to limit their indiscriminate effects, and then a rule on their recording their placement and on their removal. But once again, these rules are not the same as those found in treaty laws. They are less detailed, but they sort of summarize a large number of instances of practice, of considerations, statements, and so on and so forth. So they are rules that are not as such to be found in treaty law. And the third example I wanted to give is the one on blinding laser weapons, which have been outlawed by a protocol adopted in 1995, if I'm not mistaken. So this is 10 years ago now. And we found this prohibition to be customary, notwithstanding the fact that maybe, I mean, now, of course, 10 years later, it seems more reasonable, but at a few years ago, people were still sort of surprised because it had been so recent that this ban had been accepted, and yet we found it to be customary. So custom today obviously doesn't require centuries-old practice, but can develop rather quickly, as we've seen with the protection of peacekeeping forces, blinding laser weapons, prohibition of all types of sexual violence, as culminated in the ICC statute. So I just wanted to give a few examples there. These are, of course, not the typical example, because the run-of-the-mill rule will be very familiar to you and will be very, will follow more closely, I would say, the formulation to be found in treaties. So the main conclusions then of the study are that notwithstanding the fact that a number of treaties haven't been universally ratified, we nevertheless see that there is a widespread acceptance of basic rules and principles, such as on the conduct of hostilities, such as on the treatment of persons in the power of a party to any party to the conflict. Secondly, we also see that with these 147 rules, that the normative applicable in international and non-international conflicts, that the normative framework for non-international armed conflicts is more detailed in treaty law, in customary law. So states really, through their practice, have developed a number of requirements, obligations that apply across the board. And this is the third point, that a common standard of behavior has been established in state practice that is applicable in all armed conflicts, regardless of ratification of treaties, regardless of whether the conflict is international or non-international. There are certain things that are required of parties to a conflict and certain things that are absolutely prohibited. And if you look at the content of these rules, then you will understand why, because they make sense. They are things that should not be done and that have been regarded as inhuman and that have to be outlawed. So these are the main conclusions of the study. As Jeff said, obviously it's not the last word of custom. There's always room for debate on the content of customary international law. Nevertheless, we think that we have done fairly careful research, very extensive, broad-based research, and so if we are going to have discussions about the content of these customary rules, that these discussions should really be based on the facts, on what the practice is, what exists, and maybe we have missed some practices. This is definitely possible. But so if we're going to have discussions then this should be based on the practice. Thank you very much.
So now we have about half an hour for questions and answers. The second panel, we didn't kind of give you an overview of the day, the second panel that we'll be having will be made up of a variety of experts from a variety of different perspectives, including the other primary author of the report, who will talk about varying points of controversy and support for the report itself. But if you have questions now, we have about half an hour. I would ask you to come to the microphones and to switch on at the bottom of the microphone the battery. So it's great. There's no controversy, no questions. It's fabulous.
We can have questions after the other.
Yeah. There's a little. Yeah.
Hello. Good morning.
And if you can identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Major Tony Raimondo. I'm the human rights instructor at the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. And I have a question concerning direct participation of civilians in non-international armed conflicts. And I understand you said that it's not clearly defined, but can you give us some examples as to what would constitute, in your opinion, direct participation? Thank you.
Well, there's some people in this room who are more expert on this question as me, as having participated in the expert meetings so far, but Obviously, there's one example that everyone agrees with constitute direct participation, namely taking up arms and causing direct damage to enemy forces. I mean, shooting, sabotaging a bridge, and so on. The controversy goes more if you go away from the battlefield and you go to the preparation of military actions, coordination, financing, and then also, particularly in non-international armed conflicts, the issue of housing rebels, feeding them, sympathizing with them, where in the past some people have been attacked on that basis, but this, for example, by the Inter-American Commission, hasn't been found to be sufficient reason to attack civilians because they housed or fed rebel groups, because often, and that's the difference maybe between international and non-international armed conflicts, often in non-international armed conflicts, when rebel forces enter a village, the civilians living there are forced to cooperate with them. So it would be very unfortunate if they don't cooperate, they may get killed by the rebels. And if they do cooperate, and this would be considered direct participation, that they would be liable to attack by the government forces. So, but all these issues are currently under discussion. In particular, there's going to be a meeting next month in October in Geneva, where specific examples will be discussed, and that there has been a questionnaire sent out to a number of people. And so the idea is to come up with some guidelines as to how this concept should be interpreted.
And I have a couple questions, and since no one else is asking, I'll just go right ahead. One question that has to do with whether or not any countries, in fact, have objected to this and said, oh no, we think you have it wrong. Has the U.S. government taken a position? And to the extent that some states did want to object, you know, how would that happen? You mentioned it in passing, so that's sort of one thing I'd be interested in your comments on. The other is, how do you envision these rules being used by the ICC or future tribunals or even states? I mean, do you in fact think that people will be charged and they'll say, rule number 60 says blank and there is a violation of this? I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
No, so far, I mean, the study was published in March, so it's a pretty big publication, and reactions have been slow to come in. I guess government officials need time also to look through it. I guess they're about around rule 50 now. So we still have a while to go before we receive objections. I don't expect objections to the study as such, because we were asked to do this, so states cannot object to us having done this. But obviously, as I said, there is room for argument always about the exact scope of these rules, about the formulation of the rules. There are also issues in the commentary, and I would like to underline that we only found the rules to be customary, and the commentaries contain a number of considerations from practice where we could not clearly find a rule of customary international law. For example, the issue of doubt is discussed in the commentary, obviously because we couldn't identify a rule. So, but I think that a number of governments may be working on their position, their ideas about what some of the rules should say, and maybe some observations with respect to some rules. And I think this is normal. I mean, this is to be expected. How can we envisage these rules to be used? Well, I think the rules, maybe we shouldn't ask the question, how do you envisage these rules to be used, but this study to be used? Because, of course, it's an incredible, if I may say myself, source of information on practice, and so anyone who has to work on customary international law obviously can look at the rules, but can also look for themselves at the practice and can look at the reasoning behind the rules, and can use the reasoning made. So they do not necessarily have to say a tribunal that you're charged because you violated Rule 53, but you can say you're charged on the basis of customary international law. And this rule is customary because see how much practice there is, and rely on the sources. And in fact, that has happened already in the ICTY, in an interlocutory appeal in the Hadzianovic case, which concerns issues of command responsibility in a non-international armed conflict. The court has not said, yes, command responsibility as customer because it's in the study, its rule so much. No, it has done its own exercise, but obviously relied on the practice that we have collected. And so this can also be done by states in that manner. I guess there will be some states which go straight to the rules and others which want to do their own exercise. So that's why I think it should be seen as an effort in assisting states in clarifying the content of customer international law, which otherwise is a very arduous task. And so we've sort of helped out and given a blueprint for what the situation of customer international law is.
Additional questions?
Yes, they are all waiting for the panel.
Okay. They're still waking up.
My name is Lisa Hajar from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Two questions. One, the three issues that were under consideration for future development strike me among the sort of forms of violence that they would raise is assassinations, and whether or not, like, what the status might be of the legality of assassinations as a tactic of war, attacking somebody at a time when he or she is not directly involved in hostilities. And the second question is, with this kind of extremely useful clarification, what is the impact, do you think, or would you anticipate on the expansion of universal jurisdiction type prosecutions?
Excuse me, can you repeat the last question?
Just in terms of clarifying what is customary international law, would you anticipate that this might lend itself to increasing prosecutions in national courts of foreigners on the basis of universal jurisdiction?
Well, I think that wouldn't necessarily happen because of this study. We already see it happening. I mean, the rule has been out there, it's been available, but obviously for practical reasons it's not that simple to prosecute a foreigner for war crimes committed abroad. So, but it does exist. It has been used, and maybe it will be used increasingly. This also depends on the success of ad hoc criminal tribunals and the permanent international criminal court that would discharge states really of this difficult task of going after war criminals and doing investigations in different countries. With respect to assassination, there is also a discussion of this issue in one of the rules, and I can indicate to you, you have to think about exactly where it is. I can indicate that to you in the coffee break. But that would indeed be one of the areas where maybe some more clarification is also required. I just gave a few examples of issues that aren't clear. I didn't also necessarily say that these all need to be developed, but I think at least because there is maybe not that much room left for development of IHL, but there's definitely a lot of room left for clarification. I mean, an example which I didn't give, but I could add it, is the principle of proportionality, which is clearly established, widely supported in practice, but that practice doesn't give much more guidelines as to how the military importance of an objective is to be weighed against the incidental civilian losses and damage to civilian objects. So you find a lot of support for the principle, but less on the side of clarification. So I think maybe in IHL the time has come after so many years to clarify some principles which are still not very clear.
I'm Eric Iverson. I'm a student here at the Washington College of Law. First of all, I'd like to thank the ICRC and Professor Goldman for putting together this conference. I think it's a testament to this school's dedication to this field of law, international humanitarian law, that goes all the way back to Wally Solf and Professor Goldman, and also former dean, now Judge Brugenthal. My question is, I think it's fair to say that the first part of the study was done prior to the events of September 11th, and the second part of the study, or maybe not the second part, but it's kind of September 11th kind of put the study into halves. What affected the events of September 11th and current state practice, and what has happened since September 11th, have on the study in terms of looking at what states are doing now according to the Geneva Conventions and according to other treaties and customary international law in this field?
Yeah, if you say according to the Geneva Conventions, obviously I mentioned we didn't that was not the focus of the study, and what has been done in accordance with the Geneva Conventions, the interpretation of the Geneva Conventions, hasn't been the focus of the study. I should also mention that the collection of practice ended at the end of 2002. There was practice included from 2003, but so recent conflicts, in particular those in Afghanistan and Iraq, practice related to that has not yet been included. And so obviously practice runs ahead of you, and if you try to finalize volume two in order to finalize volume one, by the time you're done, practice again has gone ahead of you. But I think in this particular case, probably for most of these rules, these conflicts haven't challenged the principles of distinction or proportionality, the prohibition of pillage or the prohibition of sexual violence. I'm taking just a few obvious examples, but with respect to the interpretation of specific provisions of the Geneva Conventions, the qualification of persons as armed forces, militia, the entitlement to prisoner of war status and all that was not the focus of the study.
Were there any customary rules that you thought might be, or any rules that you thought might be customary that people, after all the events happened, the current events, that people took another glance at it and thought maybe this is not customary because of current state practice?
Well, I don't know about that. That's for those persons to make that argument, as I said, based on the facts. But custom is I have to admit, not made by one state, but by the large number of states. So these customary rules have been formed on the basis of widespread, extensive, and representative practice, and that's the only way they can be changed.
No other questions. I do have another question. Just the release of the study kept on. I noticed that it kept on being put off. You know, initially it was going to be released, I think, in 2003, and then 2004, and then 2005. Is that due to what has happened since September 11th, or
no,
is that just?
Not at all. It's due to the fact that we still, before finalizing the study, wanted to have a final round of consultations with the experts. And so that, because we finalized the draft in 2003, and instead of publishing it then, we waited and we finalized in 2004, end of August, and it came out in 2005. I mean, there's also the publication time and all that. But it was purely considerations of making sure that everyone has seen the final version and has had time to react to it.
Thank you.
Frederik van Este from the Katholieke Universiteit Leuven, Belgium. I have a small question. Given the fact that you concentrate so much on the spoken word, could we say that, in fact, you emphasize opinio iuris more than usus, and that you believe that, in fact, the dictates of humanity and so on are much more important than the real behavior of states, so in a way that you, in fact, tend to say, as in the Kupreskic case from the ICTY, that we should focus on opinio iuris and not as much on the real behavior of states, because it's such an important issue here.
Well, as I said, the real behavior when it consists of things that are generally seen to be violations doesn't, I mean, that's what the ICJ said in the Nicaragua case, is not of a nature to challenge the rule, but reinforces the rule in effect, because states keep referring back to the fact that what you're doing is prohibited. And I would also challenge your, so we're not focusing on opinio iuris as only being able to formulate custom international law. And I wouldn't say that I disagree that I said that we focus on the spoken word. I mean, first of all, lots of it is written. And secondly, what is those verbal acts, as I said, do reflect a large amount of practice. But I challenge anyone in this room here, how you gonna write a volume on practice where you say on the 5th of March 2005, soldier X in Iraq treated prisoner Y correctly, humanely. I mean, that is practice which supports. And why did he do so? Because it's in his manual, his superiors told him so, and others who hadn't done so were punished. I mean, that is the practice, but you can't write practice that way. So the way you, I mean, how are you going to compile a set of how are you going to compile the practice in that respect? So there's a lot of practice which supports the rule which is in compliance, but which is sort of invisible, but which is summarized or extrapolated in these military manuals, in this legislation. And if you like, this legislation, these acts, then constitute at the same time practice or reflect practice, but also reflect what is, in the opinion of the country issuing these documents, legal. Because, of course, what state practice, what they officially practice, what they publish, is also what they consider to be in compliance with their international legal obligations. Yes. Yeah.
Jordan Pass from Houston. I was just curious. I haven't read all of Part 2. Was there any attention to questions of immunity of insurgents during a non-international armed conflict, like combatant immunity for members of the armed forces of a party to an international armed conflict? I would suspect that status of a detained person is irrelevant still today in terms of their treatment under GC3, Common Article 3. They must all be treated humanely, et cetera, and there's a whole panoply of rights and duties set forth. So status would be irrelevant. They're not directly participating in an armed conflict once they're detained. And similarly, I would assume that the customary law is that there is no immunity, so status is irrelevant after capture. They could be prosecuted, in other words, for violating the domestic law of the state in which they're captured if they've committed unlawful killing of human beings, for example. Was there any attention to questions of immunity? Is there a practice out there that I was missing concerning a granting of immunity by the state against insurgents, for example?
No, I mean, we have the fundamental rule that what combatants have to do in order to be entitled to prisoner of war status. But on this specific question, I think in practice this has, in non-international conflicts, mostly played out through the question of amnesties. So obviously, I mean, I agree and that these insurgents are liable to prosecution. But at the end of a conflict, in order to achieve peace and as required by IHL, the widest measure of amnesty must be granted, except for war crimes. But it's again, the attention of the study to these questions is fairly limited because it's issues deriving from the GCs, and that was not the primary focus of the study.
Hello, my name is Shaku Shikolaslami. I'm a student at WCL. I had a question about the role of drawing on international human rights law in formulating customary law in the realm of international humanitarian law. What role did it play in your study? Whether there has been any debate surrounding this role in your study, and whether you think your study has taken steps to further kind of interconnect the two fields.
I assume that Luis will say something about this on the panel, but I would just say that in particular in a chapter 32 on fundamental guarantees, which refers to a number of provisions that are also to be found, for example, in Article 75 of Protocol 1, we do find corresponding rules in human rights law, and so we've also looked at those. The study is not an assessment of customary human rights law. Obviously, it's customary humanitarian law. But to the extent that these rules also exist in human rights law and are non-derogable, so are considered to be applicable at all times, we've referred to them as reinforcing similar rules existing in humanitarian law. But I guess that we will discuss this issue probably further during the panel.
My name is Eloise de Walsing, Leiden University. My question relates to the Sanremo Manual on Naval Warfare. As I understand it, that study has been conducted with a very different set of participants materials, and they've reached different conclusions compared to the ICRC study. My question is, were there particular views that stirred this approach, and what would you say is the consequence for the credibility of the study, just the way it has been handled? My second question...
Go ahead, yes.
My second question relates to identifying the customary nature of a rule. I mean, many different rules have not every rule is leans on a number, the same number of practice cases.
Yeah.
How do you determine what is the threshold, both for practice and opinio iuris? And what is the indication of changing a certain rule? Should there be a lot of practice? I mean, the court indicated that one case different is not necessarily enough to change a rule, but when would it be? Thank you.
Yes, I will answer only the second question, and I've called on Louise to answer the first question because she was the primary author of the San Remo manual, with which I had nothing to do. So for some cases there's less practice, and for others there's more practice. This obviously depends on the subject matter. I mean, if you take the Wimbledon case by the Permanent Court of International Justice, for example, which dealt with whether a state that is neutral may let warships pass through it through a strait, the Permanent Court only referred to the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal, two cases. But obviously there aren't that many international straits, or there weren't that many at the time to look at, and lots of passage had taken place through those canals. So it depends really on the subject matter. I mean, for some issues today, if we take the issue of blinding laser weapons, I mean, the practice that was out there consisted in attempts to develop these weapons and in statements and action taken by states in that process along with other states. But a majority of states probably weren't concerned with this issue and didn't take a position, weren't involved in the debate. And so it really depends. I mean, if you look on the issue of attacks against civilians, there, of course, you find lots and lots of practice. It's dealt with in each military manual. And a number of other subjects is less extensive. So it really depends on the subject matter. You cannot say extensive means that you have to have 150 states which have expressed themselves in a certain manner, but extensive representative refers also to the fact that those who have participated in the practice, those who are specially affected and have taken position, that those should be in agreement. So, and the second question on the change of a rule, how this can happen. I mean, we don't have that many examples of customary rules changing. If you think about the territorial sea, which used to be 3 miles and now has become 10 sea miles, 12 sea miles. So this change occurred gradually because certain states asserted a 12 sea mile territorial sea, and other states went along and didn't object, and so at a certain point this became widespread. The establishment of sovereign rights over the continental shelf started with President Truman declaring that the United States had sovereignty for the exploitation over the continental shelf in the Gulf, of the Gulf, Mexican Gulf, I believe it's called. And other states followed suit, and so this became to be established. Obviously, in the realm of customary law, if you take the rules now, it's more difficult to imagine that these rules would be changed given their nature. I mean, a change that I can think of is the fact that starvation was seen as a lawful method of warfare, that it has been outlawed in the protocols, and that since then it has been gaining increasing support to the extent that today starvation is no longer seen as a lawful method of warfare. So it's really but now to go back from starvation is unlawful to starvation becomes lawful again. You see, that's quite a different issue than going from 3 sea miles to 12 sea miles, because, well, whether it's 3 or 12 or 10 or 14, I mean, it's goes less to the heart of international law or to the principles protecting persons than goes the issue of whether starvation should be allowed, starvation of civilians should be a lawful method of warfare or not. And I will pass to Louise now for the San Remo manual.
On the San Remo manual, indeed I was the primary organizer of that series of meetings which came up with that San Remo manual, and I actually was one who hired Jean-Marie in order to start working on the customary law project. And so at the initial stages, I was also in charge of the deciding on the beginnings of the methodology of this study. I don't consider myself to have been inconsistent, and I'll explain why between one study and the other. The first thing you have to be aware of is the fact that naval warfare has always been very different in its content and its methodology compared with land warfare. This dates from centuries of practice, and it's basically because economic warfare at sea is something which has been very widely practiced. And the effect of sea activities on neutrals is much more important in naval warfare than in land warfare. Now, all this means that what may seem contradictory between the San Remo manual and this customary law study is actually not contradictory. What we have indicated clearly in the introduction to this study is that we have intentionally excluded naval warfare because it is a very separate body of law that has many of its own rules, which really are not at all similar to those of the rules relating to land warfare, which includes, by the way, air to land. And the naval warfare manual, we still do also air to sea, and sometimes air sometimes if it is over the sea. And with regard to the methodology, we had to have a series of meetings which included the consultation of specialists, governmental and others, from states which are the most important from this point of view. So in other words, all the major naval powers, military naval powers, were included in the study. And also we included representatives of major seafaring nations, because as neutral nations, they would be the ones which would be affected by the rules allowing search and seizure, for example, or capture at sea. There was not much point, to be honest, in consulting a whole series of landlocked nations or those who just have a few coastal fishing vessels in looking at the law of naval warfare. And that's why the actual methodology was different. And to be honest, the degree of collection of material, to be honest, simply didn't need to be as wide, because if you're looking at naval warfare, the amount of practice by definition is physically that much less than the amount of practice required for sea warfare. Sorry, for land warfare.
On that note, maybe it's a good time to break and to invite you all to have coffee outside. We'll reconvene here at 10:45, 10:45, and we'll have our panel discussion. Thank you.
All right, we're going to begin our second panel. It would take too long to give introductions to all of the speakers, who are all very distinguished in their respective fields. So without any further information, we'll begin with Professor Louise Doswald Beck, whom, as you know, is the co-author of the ICRC study. Please, Louise.
Thanks very much, Bob. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today. I have, you said, 12 minutes, is that right? To make sure I don't overreach. Okay, in that case, I shall try to be brief on a few general points. The first is that, and I don't want to repeat anything that Jean-Marie said, but I do want to stress the fact that at the very beginning of this study, the question was very much one of, well, how shall the presentation be? And I will say that together with the steering committee, it was very much my view that it was important to have not only this volume one, but also to publish the material, the practice, which we used in order to make the evaluation. Why? Because we thought that it was more honest and also more useful for people to be able to look themselves at the detailed practice and make, if they like, their own evaluation. They can look at our reasoning, but at least the practice is there. The other thing I want to say in that regard, why it took so long. The practice as we collected in Volume 2 did not look like that when we first collected it. We collected it in the just big, rough subject areas that Jean-Marie listed, those six parts. And then it was very much a question of plowing through this practice. I mean, there are cupboards worth of practice. It's just huge amounts, much more than the two volumes you sit there, in order to see whether we could glean inductively certain rules. And the first rough effort we made to make rules, then as we make, it's the wrong way of putting it, finding rules, we then looked at the practice again to see if it really does stand up. And sometimes it didn't. There wasn't enough at the end of the day, or some of the practice wasn't useful enough, or somehow didn't quite fit what we thought. So that meant rearranging again. So it was a final rearrangement. I mean, we did three sets of rearrangement, if you like, in order to, when we finally found rules which we thought inductively are valuable, we then put the practice relevant to each rule. But that was the final stage, if you like, and then after that we wrote the commentary. It was a very, very long and complex process. And in that regard, I'd like to say I don't think any court on this planet has ever, when declaring a rule of customary law, has ever gone through this kind of exercise. Okay, having made that point, there's two points of substance which I would like to raise, and these were raised in the questions, and there were points which I think are interesting anyway. The first is the role of human rights when we're looking at international humanitarian law. I think it is abundantly clear that human rights mentality, and indeed human rights law, has had a direct effect on international humanitarian law. You only have to look at the wording of the additional protocols of 1977 to recognize rules which are typically worded in human rights language. And indeed, the degree of effect now is such that you can't even say anymore that you've got airtight, watertight, different branches of law. Why? Look at the additional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child that deals with child soldiers. How would you categorize that? In other words, I think these days, although it is still true that you've got two branches of law, humanitarian law, human rights law, they're not as watertight as they used to be. And therefore, when you look at behavior in an armed conflict situation, it is these days impossible to completely push to one side and pretend it's not there human rights law. Because a certain amount of human rights law, for those who know it, is not only formally non-derogable, but also a great deal of practice by the treaty bodies and also by state practice itself through resolutions, including Security Council, have introduced a lot of human rights law as applicable in armed conflict situations as such. Therefore, we did actually ask the question very early on in the big consultation, as to say the wider consultation with governments as well, should we have a chapter on human rights law that's applicable to armed conflict as well? With two exceptions, two individuals, actually they were both academics as it so happens, all the others were in favour that it was a good idea to do so. In the end, we slightly changed the approach. We wrote what we called instead a fundamental guarantees chapter. Why fundamental guarantees? Because they represent fundamental rules in human rights, both treaty law but also state practice. It's true we haven't made an evaluation. This is customary human rights law, but there's enough practice out there to show that these are values which the international community clearly wishes to see respected in armed conflict. And also you have humanitarian law actually saying the same thing. It has only been in the case of, I can only think of one rule, in that fundamental guarantees chapter, which has been a bit which I would say we borrowed a bit from human rights law to make it a rule that applies to non-international armed conflict as well, and that is the registration of persons when they're held in detention. As it so happens, you don't have a treaty rule to that effect, but the prohibition of disappearances is such, together with the rule that one must register in international armed conflicts, that we felt the general expectation is that one does register people, one does not disappear people, not even in internal armed conflicts. Apart from that, I would say the rest is so straightforward, it's all in IHL anyway, but it's reinforced by human rights law. The other aspect of the fundamental guarantees, which actually answers partly Jordan's question, is that human rights law does not categorize people. In human rights law, everyone is entitled to fair trial. Everyone is entitled not to be tortured. Whereas in typical treaty law of humanitarian law, you've got the rights of prisoners of war, you've got the rights of civilians, you've got the rights of the sick and wounded, etc. But most of those overlap completely. And we decided it was slightly absurd to put in categories and repeat ourselves constantly for each category rules which are fundamental to all persons which are in the power of the adversary, usually through detention. Then the other point that I wanted to raise is one which was brought up and which I know has led to a certain amount of controversy, especially here. And I think is worth looking at a little bit, and that is the question of where there used to be a customary rule in one direction, and then there is that customary rule loses the support of the majority of nations, and then there is a new customary rule that may come if there's sufficient support by a majority of nations to create that new customary rule. Now, in the case of starvation of civilians and relief shipments, for example, including for non-international armed conflicts, there we felt that there was enough support that was widespread, almost uniform, representative, etc. There was no difficulty in saying, right, okay, that was the old rule, but now, with state practice as it is now, there is now a new rule. And there's no doubt that those new rules were influenced by the protocols, but it wasn't the protocols that made the new customary rules. In that regard, a little parenthesis, I have heard of an article saying that we have just decided the protocols are customary. It's simply not true. Just read the thing yourself and you'll see it's not true. Anyway, coming back to what I want to say now. The area which I would say was the most difficult in this regard was looking at the whole question of reprisals, especially reprisals when it came, which related to the attacking of civilians during hostilities. I'm not talking about civilians in detention. That is very clear, no problem. The fact is that the rule used to exist that it was possible to attack civilians by reprisal during hostilities. However, it is also clearly the case that that rule has lost the support of the vast majority of the international community. Not only lost support, but the vast majority of the international community positively believes that it is unlawful to do so. There are precisely three states in this world which have what I would call fairly, but not entirely, but more or less unambiguous practice, but as even so, it's not completely unambiguous, to the effect that such reprisals should be lawful. And so I have to admit that as an academic, I was very tempted to say, well, it's only three states. That is almost uniform. You've got a new rule. But, you know, caution, etc. So what is the situation? The situation in that kind of situation is the fact I've only seen one professor address this issue, and that's Professor Ian Brownlee, the University of Oxford, also a member of the International Law Commission, who said that if you've got a situation whereby a customary law has lost its support, but you haven't got yet in exactly the same behavior, a sufficient majority or a sufficient almost uniform support for a new rule, then there is no rule, and one has instead a situation of mutual bilateral obligations. So in other words, those states, what it boiled down to therefore is those states which believe that such reprisals are lawful can use such reprisals against each other from a pure international law point of view. But having said that, I have to admit that I also wrote in that chapter, which was was approved at the end of the day, that one has to take into account also other bodies of international law, not only the Martens Clause, not only case law, but also the concept, the fundamental concept of human rights law, to the effect that human beings are not their government. Human beings have their own rights. And this does influence at the end of the day. So in other words, what I'm trying to say by this is, although this study has analyzed what is customary international humanitarian law, I'd like to stress the fact that please be aware that there are other bodies of law out there which cannot be ignored when one is evaluating whether a particular rule exists, yes or no, to an armed conflict situation. I know the US has a formal position that human rights law doesn't apply in armed conflict situations. It has not always applied this rule for itself because it has voted in favor of resolutions looking at human rights violations by Russia in Afghanistan and by Iraq and Kuwait. But it is abundantly clear that human rights law does apply in armed conflict for all kinds of reasons that I don't have time to go into now. But if you would like to discuss that further, I'm very happy to do so. And I think I have used up my 12 minutes.
Great Swiss efficiency. Our next speaker will be Joshua L. Dorison, Office of Legal Advisor.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to make several remarks, but I think I'm going to limit my remarks today to sort of a basic theme, which is the methodology of the report. At the outset, I do want to stress that I'm appearing today in a personal capacity. I'm not necessarily reflecting the views of our government on the study, but that shouldn't necessarily be surprising when one sees the size of the undertaking. It's a mammoth undertaking. And in response to an earlier question that was posed, whether we have a view, whether we intend to develop a view, I think Hayes and I have discussed this. I think it's definitely something that's in our interest. We're going to take the time to look carefully at the study. But it will take time. I mean, it's frankly an enormous research work. A few immediate reactions. I think my first reaction upon looking at the study and starting to use it was to agree with a point that Jeff Lone made at the outset. This is a very useful thing for us. We sort of eagerly awaited the study. We had one copy initially. It came into my office. And frankly, I haven't been able to keep it on the shelf in my office. It's something that people use constantly. It's an important research tool. That said, I do now, having had an opportunity to use it over the last several months, have some reservations and concerns about the study, and in particular about the methodology of the study. I've participated on other panels. I've heard others comment on the study. I've read what others have had to say about the study. And what I'd like to do is maybe set out a variety of questions. I think maybe better to pose them as questions today about the study's methodology and encourage you out there and others on the panel today to think about these questions. At first blush, I don't think there's a lot of controversy in the international community about what constitutes customary international law. And I think Jean-Marie and pointing to the general rule was stating something that isn't so controversial, that most practitioners and commentators would tend to look to a general and consistent pattern of practice followed by states and followed by them from a sense of legal obligation or a pino juris. I think it's also fair to say that most in looking at these two elements would want to think about issues like how do specially affected states perform? Are there states out there that are persistently objecting to the formulation of a particular rule? And I think that my reactions and the reactions of others that I've read have focused both on the state practice side and on the Apino Iura side in framing the questions that I think are worth thinking about today. One of the basic problems with state practice in this field is that so much of the practice is already, or so much of this field is already covered by conventions. And so it raises a basic question as to whether one can draw conclusions about customary international law from the practice of states, which is basically an implementation of a treaty obligation. I think it's a difficult thing to resolve, and I've seen commentary on both sides. I tend to agree that it may be difficult to draw conclusions that states in implementing treaty obligations are actually evidencing a practice that's reflective of customary international law. But again, I'll pose it as a question. I'd be interested in what others would think about this. Others have pointed to an excessive reliance on military manuals in the state practice section, raising the concern that states place rules in military manuals for a variety of reasons, not always because they think they're legally obligated to do so. Often, practice that's reflected in the manuals is based on a policy of including a certain rule rather than a sense that the rule flows from a legal obligation. And if it does flow from a legal obligation, it sort of comes back to the question of whether it's flowing from a treaty obligation or from a sense that they're bound as a matter of customary international law. Others have pointed to the reliance in the study on the practice of non-states, NGOs and others, questioning whether that is practice that could be interpreted as evidence of customary international law. And others have pointed to the reliance of the study on non-binding resolutions in various fora, including the General Assembly. So I would sort of pose those basic questions about the state practice side. In terms of Apino Iuris, this is the area where I sort of personally have had the hardest time coming up with a view. I think the study is honest in setting out the challenges of finding Apino Iuris, and it says in the study's introduction that it proved very difficult and largely theoretical to strictly separate the elements of practice from legal conviction. And I think that the rule that they basically devised in the methodology was to look to the density of practice as allowing one to infer Apino Iuris. So if there's a sufficient density of practice, then Apino Iuris, which may otherwise be difficult to find, you know, statements or acts, they're premised on a sort of clear view that they are doing a certain act because they believe that there is a legal obligation to do that act and that legal obligation flows from customary international law. Quite difficult to find that. And so they've adopted a sort of density of practice approach as justifying Apino Iuris. Now, personally, I think this is something that needs to be discussed, needs to be sort of considered. I'm skeptical that one can rely heavily on the density of practice approach, but it's clearly something that we'll be looking at as we sort of look more carefully at the study as a whole. I guess the last issue that I just frame for discussion today is the degree to which the rules that have been announced are announced as rules that are binding as a matter of customary international law, both in international armed conflict and non-international armed conflict. And this is an important point because many of the rules that are derived are sort of readily identifiable to the additional protocols. And the additional protocols, of course, Protocol 1 applies in international armed conflict, Protocol 2 in non-international armed conflict. I think the basic position of the study, and this is one of the three basic conclusions that Jean-Marie noted, is that the effect of, or the evidence that they found seemed to indicate that rules that are contained in additional Protocol 1 are in fact applicable in non-international conflict as well, which to me is a surprising result considering the number of countries that specifically have not signed up to the additional protocols or additional Protocol 1. And so to develop a theory that would bind states as a matter of customary international law to rules that many states specifically chose not to sign up to in the context of specific conventions, I think will be viewed as a surprising result. I'll just quote Daniel Bethlehem, who I think appeared in one of the earlier panels on the study, who pointed out, with respect to this point, that that when one looks at the states that have not signed up to the additional protocols, they tend to represent a virtual, and these are his words, who's who of the states that have engaged in conflict over the past 30 years. And so it gets back to one of the questions I raised earlier. To the extent that you have specially affected states that as a set have not signed up to certain protocols, and then you have a study that seeks to announce rules binding as a matter of customary international law on specially affected states, I think it raises sort of particularly challenging questions about methodology. So I think at this point I'll stop and look forward to questions from others.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker will be Professor Michael Matheson.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to take part in this panel. I want to start by adding my congratulations to Dr. Hinkerts and Professor Doswald Beck on their monumental achievement in producing this comprehensive study. I think it's bound to become a significant event in the field for many years to come, and I suspect that it's going to be an important step in the further development of both customary and conventional international humanitarian law. So I congratulate them both for that. Well, I have 10 minutes, and of course it's not possible to deal with all the various interesting aspects of the subject, but I want to concentrate my comments on two aspects. First is the question of the role of dissenting states in the formulation of customary law, something of particular relevance to the United States. And secondly, the problem of this gap in conventional law and treaty law between international and non-international conflicts and the extent to which customary law can help bridge that gap. First, let me start with the problem of the dissenting state. The study lays out a theoretical framework for this. It says to establish a rule of customary law, state practice has to be virtually uniform. It must be extensive and representative. It need not be universal, but it must include the concurring practice of states whose interests are specially affected. The study raises the question of whether it's legally possible in this field for a dissenting state to be a persistent objector, but it doesn't take a view on the matter. Of course, the application of these concepts to specific situations is far from straightforward, and I think you can see this problem reflected in various parts of the study. Just to take one example, the prohibition in Article 35 of Additional Protocol 1 on means and methods of warfare that may be expected to cause widespread, long-term, and severe damage to the natural environment. The study finds that this has become customary law because of what it considers to be virtually uniform acceptance, notwithstanding the fact that there are objections in whole or in part by the United States, the United Kingdom, and France. The study seems to accept that these states are especially affected as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, but not as far as conventional weapons are concerned. It seems to accept that these states qualify as persistent objectors with respect to the application of the rule to nuclear warfare, and that the United States is a persistent objector with respect to conventional warfare, but again takes no view upon whether that doctrine actually does apply in the field of customary law. Well, leaving aside the substance of this particular provision on environmental warfare, which in fact I think is a fairly reasonable rule of conduct, I confess that I am generally skeptical that rules concerning the use of weapons, whether nuclear or conventional, could actually become customary law in the face of objection by these three major military powers. And obviously this is particularly relevant to the United States, which is the major military power in the world, which is frequently involved in conflicts and coalition operations, which is a leader in the development of both weapons and military doctrine. I think at a minimum that it's unlikely that the United States could be bound in the face of persistent objection by it, even in this field of international humanitarian law. But on the other hand, I would say that in a situation where a major military power like the United States has declined to become a party to a treaty, but at the same time accepts certain of the principles contained in that treaty, that acceptance is bound to have a very significant effect on the prospects for the incorporation of those principles into customary law. For example, when the U.S. government decided in the 1980s that it was not going to ratify Additional Protocol 1, at the same time it made clear that it did support various principles contained in the protocol, that it believed that they were either customary law or should become so. And that included various principles on means and methods of warfare, and included the fundamental guarantees in Article 75 of Protocol 1. And the ICRC study concludes that most of these principles have become customary law, which I agree with, and I would suggest that the acceptance by the United States, even though a dissenter from the protocol, was essential to that result, which I think illustrates that it is often the position of the important dissenters to a treaty regime that may go far in determining how much of that regime actually becomes customary law. And it's sometimes in this process of dissent that customary law may crystallize around those parts of the treaty that dissenters accept. Nonetheless, I want to say that neither the United States nor any other major military power can effectively protect its interests or advance international law generally by confining itself to the role of a perpetual dissenter. And it's particularly important for the United States, in particular, to take a proactive approach in the development of both customary and conventional law, and to adhere to international instruments that adequately protect its interests when those instruments are available. Well, next let me address this question of the gap in treaty law and conventional law between international and non-international conflicts and how customary law might help to fill that gap. Well, as we know, and as others have already suggested, the conventional law of armed conflict has historically dealt with international conflicts in a fairly rigorous and detailed and comprehensive way, whereas in most cases that treaty law has dealt with non-international conflicts in a less comprehensive and detailed way. This difference, of course, is obvious in the 1949 Geneva Conventions, where you have hundreds of detailed provisions on international conflict, essentially one provision, Common Article 3, on non-international conflicts. Additional Protocol 2 was a significant improvement in many respects, but it was still seriously deficient with respect to the rules on means and methods of warfare and the protection of the civilian population in internal conflicts. And even the statute of the International Criminal Court, which in many ways represented an important further advance in this area, still it does include certain important principles only with respect to international conflicts and not with respect to internal conflicts. These historic gaps in treaty law between the two kinds of conflicts are compounded in practice by the fact that states are often much less clear in their statements about customary law with respect to internal conflicts, and the record of their actual observance in armed conflict of these principles is less commendable and less rigorous than with respect to international conflicts. Fortunately, the ICRC study is able to point to various other sources for the application of these principles in non-international conflicts. Now, in particular, the Conventional Weapons Convention broke some very important ground in applying to non-international conflicts various key principles on means and methods of warfare that were left out of Additional Protocol 2. And likewise, the decisions, the jurisprudence of the International Criminal Tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda recognized as applicable to internal conflicts many of these same principles. So the question is, to what extent are these various indications of customary law status adequate to fill the gaps that still exist between treaty provisions on international and treaty provisions on non-international conflicts? Well, I think clearly the ICRC study is very helpful. I suspect it will, in fact, become in itself an important factor in moving states toward recognition of these principles in internal conflicts. And I think certainly the imposition of criminal liability by international tribunals is very useful in helping to bring home to states and to persuade states of the fact that these principles should apply. Obviously, the development of a growing consensus among governments in favor of the application of these principles in such conflicts is essential. But I think it has to be said that there would be advantages if it were possible in due course to consolidate this development by incorporating these rules into treaty form that's applicable to all non-international conflicts. For example, hypothetically, by amendment to Additional Protocol 2. I say this for several reasons. A treaty text can be more specific and definitive in ways that are more difficult to achieve by the articulation of customary law based on general practice. A ratified treaty will inevitably carry more weight in the states that are party to it than secondary sources such as tribunal decisions or commentary like the ICRC study. I think a ratified treaty text is more likely to be incorporated into municipal law, into military manuals, into domestic court decisions. And I think that a ratified treaty can provide specific procedures for prosecution and enforcement that are a little more difficult to draw out of an examination of customary law. But on the other hand, one has to acknowledge that there might be some definite risks in that kind of a treaty negotiation process. It might turn out that states, in fact, will be less prepared to accept the full scope and rigor of these rules, and that some compromises might be necessary, as is often true in a negotiation that might water down some of these principles. It's possible that such a negotiation might become entangled in political disputes relating to current conflicts, like the treatment of detainees or issues relating to occupied territory. Might take considerable time for states to ratify. Some of these ratifications might come with significant reservations. And all of these problems would have to be carefully considered in deciding whether to attempt such a negotiation to consolidate these provisions in treaty form. But I think in the end, this kind of consolidation into treaty form, if generally accepted by states, would probably be the most secure way of ensuring that these principles are actually followed in internal conflicts. When the day comes when that negotiation is politically feasible, I think we'll find that the ICRC study is going to be both an essential basis for and an impetus for the consolidation of this law. And I think, therefore, for many reasons, we have to congratulate these people on this incredible achievement. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mike. Our next speaker is going to be Burris Carnahan.
Thank you, Professor Goldman. I'd like to look briefly at how a legal practitioner might make use of the ICRC study and raise a few caveats about that use. Any American lawyer looking at the ICRC study will inevitably be struck by its similarity to the American Law Institute's restatements of the law that have been issued over the past century. Structurally, both start with a pithy black-letter rule, followed by an official commentary, and then followed by citation of the primary sources on which the rule and the commentary are based. And the resemblances between the ALI restatements and the study are more than structural. The ICRC study is, like the restatements, a magisterial work of legal scholarship. It's certain to be both influential and controversial. Whether one agrees or disagrees with the study on a particular point of law, from now on, any serious work of legal scholarship on customary international law will have to take account of the study's position. Now, the study also, however, shares some of the weaknesses of the restatements as a research tool. Both the restatements and the study are to be used with care, and neither should be relied upon uncritically by practitioners. Sound legal scholarship requires that an analysis of the reasoning behind the black letter rules and an assessment of whether the primary sources cited are really persuasive evidence in support of the rule. For example, take Rule 108 of the ICRC study. This, in essence, asserts that Article 47 of Additional Protocol 1 of 1977 has become customary international law. Article 47, in essence, declares that mercenaries are unlawful combatants and are not entitled to be treated as prisoners of war. Article 47 was inserted into Additional Protocol 1 as the direct result of an obsession with the concept of mercenaries by the states of sub-Saharan Africa, and was accepted by most other states at the Geneva Diplomatic Conference only because the definition of mercenary in Article 47 was thought to be so narrow that it would only apply rarely. The growing practice of using private contractors to provide security services to government activities, even in armed conflicts, has thrown the latter assumption into doubt. It is therefore startling to see what is and was essentially a regional policy elevated to the status of universal customary law. The elevation of Article 47 is especially unsettling, since it appears to be contrary to the fundamental spirit of the Geneva Conventions, which are, according to Common Article 1, to be respected in all circumstances, and which specifically prohibit special agreements among the parties, limiting the personal rights granted by the conventions. Yet Article 47 and Rule 108 eliminates the right to prisoner of war status to an entire class of combatants, even if those combatants distinguish themselves fully from the civilian population, and even if they otherwise follow the law of war themselves. If Rule 108 is correct, and customary international law now allows a state to deny prisoner of war status to mercenaries, this would have alarming juridical implications for the Geneva Conventions themselves. If Article 47 is now part of customary international law, then this custom must logically have arisen after 1977, when the Geneva Conference approved the final text of that article. In other words, this new customary rule arose after the 1949 Geneva Conventions had been in force for most of its current parties. If Rule 108 is truly a rule of customary law, then it applies to all states, including parties to the Geneva Conventions who are not parties to Additional Protocol 1. Rule 108 thus implies that specific provisions of the 1949 Geneva Conventions can be altered not only through the amendment process in the conventions themselves, but also through subsequent customary practice. Now, what evidence of state practice could have led the authors of the study to such a rather puzzling conclusion? Now, the commentary to Rule 108 asserts that, quote, numerous military manuals specify that mercenaries are not entitled to combatant or prisoner of war status, end quote. However, most of the manuals that are cited in support are manuals that were issued by states that were parties to Additional Protocol 1 or that were planning to become parties to Additional Protocol 1. These have little persuasive value as evidence of customary obligation separate from those states' treaty obligation. Now, as evidence of state practice, then, special importance, therefore, attaches to the manuals issued by Israel and the United States, two states not party to Additional Protocol 1, and who have both said that they do not intend ever to become parties to Additional Protocol 1. The relevant portion of the Israeli manual does appear to support Rule 108, since it says that Article 47 of Additional Protocol 1, quote, is accepted as customary international law and is therefore binding, end quote. On the other hand, the U.S. Air Force Commander's Handbook on the Law of Armed Conflict, the United States manual cited in support of Rule 108, reads quite differently. And I'll quote now from the pertinent part of the Commander's Handbook. Quote, in recent years, many countries have asserted that mercenaries are unlawful combatants and subject to punishment upon capture. The United States has long recognized that neutral nationals taking part in an armed conflict can encourage the escalation of that conflict, and the U.S. statutes place certain limits on the recruitment of mercenaries in this country. We have also, however, regarded mercenaries as lawful combatants entitled to PW status upon capture. The U.S. government has always protested vigorously against any attempt by other nations to punish American citizens as mercenaries, end quote. It is difficult to understand how this language can be considered to reflect state practice supporting Article 47 as a rule of customary law. At best, then, military manuals offer only ambiguous support for Rule 108 of the study. As with any other secondary source, scholars using the study, then, to research particular points of law should check the primary sources on which the black letter rules are based. Same is true of the commentary. Another example of questionable legal reasoning that appears in the commentary appears in the commentary on Rule 74. Rule 74 declares baldly that the use of chemical weapons is prohibited. By itself, this statement is undoubtedly a correct statement of customary law. Historically, however, the norm against chemical weapons has been regarded as only prohibiting the first use of those weapons in war. Once one side in the conflict had used chemical weapons, then the other side could use them freely in retaliation. The no first use character of the rule against chemical weapons was based on the numerous reservations to that effect that had been deposited by states party to the 1925 Geneva Gas Protocol, which had initially codified this rule against the use of chemical weapons in war. Now, the commentary on Rule 74 argues that, quote, there is increasing evidence that it may now be unlawful to retaliate in kind to another state's use of chemical weapons, end quote. Now, the commentary acknowledges that 21 states party to the 1925 protocol still have retaliation reservations in force. But the study argues these reservations are of little importance because 16 of those states are also party to the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention, which prohibits all use of chemical weapons, or even the possession of chemical weapons, even in retaliation for the enemy's first use. The problem is that this argument ignores the essential nature of the Chemical Weapons Convention as an arms control and disarmament treaty. Such agreements are political rather than legislative or normative in nature and create purely contractual obligations for the parties. It's doubtful, therefore, that the negotiators or the parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention intended to alter customary international law on the use of chemical weapons in war. The purely contractual nature of arms control and disarmament agreements is recognized by Article 60 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. Additional evidence of the strictly contractual nature of the convention may be found in its text. Like all major arms control agreements concluded in the last 40 years, the convention includes a supreme interest clause. Under Article 16, paragraph 2 of the convention, each party has the right, quote, to withdraw from this convention if it decides that extraordinary events related to the subject matter of this convention have jeopardized the supreme interests of its country, end quote. The need to threaten or actually carry out retaliation in kind for an enemy's first use of chemical weapons in war would be one obvious example of such a situation. And once a state has invoked the supreme interest clause to withdraw on 90 days' notice from the convention, then the obligations under customary law and the 1925 Geneva Protocol would again become important. In fact, Article 16 itself expressly recognizes, quote, that, quote, withdrawal of a state party from this convention shall not in any way affect the duty of states to continue fulfilling the obligations assumed under any relevant rules of international law, particularly the Geneva Protocol of 1925, end quote. The ICRC study of our study's treatment of the Chemical Weapons Convention under Rule 74 is in marked contrast with the treatment of the Geneva Conventions implied by Rule 108. While the study accords the former an inappropriate importance in the creation of customary law, it in effect pushes the Geneva Conventions off their pedestal as jus cogens and brings them down to the level of ordinary treaties that can be altered at the will of the parties, either through formal amendment or through the creation of new customary law. By incorporating Article 47 of Additional Protocol 1 into customary international law, the study takes the startling position that international humanitarian law can move backward. Rights codified in 1949 can apparently be obliterated by ambiguous evidence of customary practice after 1977. In conclusion, the ICRC study of customary law is clearly a monumental achievement, similar in scope and ambition to the ALI restatements of American law. Like any work of this magnitude, however, it is also a flawed achievement. And whoever relies on the study as a source of law would be well advised to also examine the reasoning and the primary sources of the study with a skeptical eye. Thank you. Thank you very much. Professor Jordan Post.
All right. I want to take a few moments to address more generally the role of customary international humanitarian law, the interface with treaty law in particular. I note at the outset, though, that some people have been arguing a theory concerned indirectly about a so-called persistent objector. I note that there are no general patterns of practice, nor general patterns of opinio iuris to support that theory. I don't know of anything more than rare dicta in cases to support such a theoretic limitation on what is otherwise by the majority of states recognized as the universal applicability of customary international law. And I think this is a very striking point here. People to my right have undoubtedly favored in the past such a theory because customary international law is not controllable by a single state, nor a few states. Customary international law is based, as the International Court of Justice recognized, in general patterns of expectation that something is legally appropriate or required, and general patterns of practice. You don't need uniformity, and it certainly is not law based in consent. We can think of, for example, Germany in the 1930s, and the German defense attempted at the IMT at Nuremberg, that Germany had not refused to ratify the 1907 Hague Convention, and was a persistent objector, if you wish, was a major participant in war, if you wish, a major participant or specially affected state. And yet the IMT at Nuremberg rightly ruled that customary international law reflected in the 1907 Hague Convention that Germany had not ratified had become custom by 1939 and was binding on the nationals of Germany as they are on the nationals of any other state. I'd like to address more generally, though, the reach of customary international law in other ways. It binds all participants in international, whatever it is, it binds all participants in international and non-international armed conflicts to the extent that it exists and is applicable. For example, insurgents during an armed conflict, not of an international character, who are nationals of a state that has not ratified the 1949 Geneva Conventions. I think Taiwan has not ratified the 1949 Geneva Conventions yet, are bound by relevant customary humanitarian law reflected, for example, in Common Article 3 of the 1949 Conventions. Thus, they are subject to prosecution for violations of Common Article 3's prohibitions, technically not as violations of treaty law as such, but of customary international law reflected in Common Article 3. That treaties can later reflect custom and bind non-signatory nations, as I intimated, was recognized by the IMT at Nuremberg. Moreover, a general participation clause in that treaty was found not to be relevant, a limiting provision in the treaty. So it is my opinion that attempted limitations, putative reservations and understandings concerning treaties as such are not necessarily relevant to the reach of customary international law once the custom is formed. It is a law that rests on its own general patterns of expectation and human behavior. Customary international law also provides relevant rights for all participants in international and non-international armed conflicts, whether or not they are nationals of a state, nation, belligerent, or other entity that has not ratified a particular treaty reflecting the same rights. One point is worth emphasizing. The nationals of a state that has ratified the 1949 Geneva Conventions are bound by and have rights under such treaties. It does not matter that such nationals are also members of an entity that is not a state, nation, or belligerent, or an insurgent group under criteria well recognized, such as Al-Qaeda. It does not matter because nationals of signatories to the Geneva Convention, such as Saudi nationals who might be members of Al-Qaeda, have duties and have rights under customary Geneva law. that would be applicable in Iraq or Afghanistan. Customary international law is universal in its reach and also provides states various competencies under international law, mirrored, for example, in Hague and Geneva law, whether or not persons under control or enemies in battle are nationals of signatories to such treaties. Thus, for example, the customary competence to detain certain persons without trial when reasonably necessary, according to the tests reflected in Articles 5, 42 to 43, and 78 of the Geneva Civilian Convention, subject to required review, can be exercised also with respect to non-signatory nationals. The same general point pertains with respect to competencies under GPW reflected in customary international law. Customary international law also provides a necessary background as an interpretive aid, as recognized internationally in Article 31 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, for example, and by the United States Supreme Court over many decades. Customary international law is background for interpretive purposes, resolving ambiguities and filling in gaps. Such a role of customary international law is all the more important with respect to norms jus cogens, or peremptory norms with respect to rights and duties of individuals. An example is the customary and jus cogens prohibition of torture, as well as cruel and inhumane and degrading treatment, such as the use of dogs for interrogation purposes, and or the stripping of persons naked for interrogation purposes. See, for example, my recent article in 43, Columbia Journal of Transnational Law, and the Rumsfeld authorizations that clearly involve complicit involvement or direct involvement in war crime activity. Another example involves the incorporation of customary human rights to due process in common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, expressly, quote, all the judicial guarantees recognized by civilized nations, unquote. Today, these include the minimum human rights to due process reflected in Article 14 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and that are mirrored also in rules of procedure and evidence and statutes of the ICTY, the ICTR, and the new ICC, but are seriously lacking, unfortunately, still in the Gitmo Military Commission rules of procedure and evidence. Another important supplement to the Geneva requirements is the customary prohibition jus cogens of disappearing individuals, as Luis has recognized, or of refusing to disclose the names or the whereabouts of persons who are detained. Customary international law can also shift limitations in the Geneva Conventions or override them. An example is the recognized applicability of rights and duties in common Article 3, not merely during insurgencies, but also during belligerencies and wars between nations and or states. Perhaps more appropriately, the rights and duties reflected in common Article 3 are a set of minimum customary rights and duties also applicable in an international armed conflict. Moreover, customary and universally applicable human rights, as Louise recognized, are applicable during war. I know of no war exclusion from a major human rights treaty. In fact, they have specific provisions for derogations, and the derogability provisions are somewhat limited. Some rights are non-derogable and obviously would apply during war. This has been recognized actually by Blunschley and other scholars way back in the 19th century. A reverse trend involves recognition of the application during an insurgency of customary limitations of weapons and tactics mirrored in the Hague law. For example, see Judge Cassese's majority opinion in the Tadich case in the appeals chamber of the ICTY. Another area of law is worth highlighting, the immunity of combatants from prosecution for the conduct that is lawful during war under the customary international laws of war. Interrelated is the customary definition of combatant, which hinges on membership in the armed forces of a belligerent nation or state during an international armed conflict, and attempts to change this test, I point out, can be dangerous for U.S. military and other military.
Customary international law also has effects domestically. For example, in a given domestic legal process, if a treaty is not directly incorporable and customary international law is, as it is in the United States, this can have significant effects in terms of litigation or prosecution, rights that people might raise as a matter of customary international law. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Our final speaker today will be Hayes Parks, who teaches the law of war course with a fellow by the name of Goldman.
I'm up here because I have some slides to speed things along. It does say push to wake up. I think it woke up. I will depend on you also being speed readers because we're going to go through this real fast. There's not a slide yet. I'll let you know. Actually, my opportunities to review the entire study have been very limited. As Jean-Marie said, it came out in March, and we've had it, but we've had a few things, other things on our plate. I did offer some comments with regard to its weapons revisions at the American Society of International Law meeting in April. 2 weeks ago, I participated in the meeting of experts writing in the Harvard Air and Law, Air and Space Warfare Law study, which is actually going to be the aerial version of the San Remo Manual International Naval War, and I delivered a paper there on protection for medical aircraft. So I decided to take advantage of the research I did there to perform what I call a biopsy on a particular portion of the customary law study to see what I could gain from that. And as I said, due to time limitations, I have to use slides for this. One of the things that I identified in April with respect to the ICRC study was its methodology. Although the introduction to the ICRC study acknowledges the importance of battlefield behavior in determining customary law, it is largely absent from the study. Governments not only write and adopt the laws of war, governments are, in fact, their executors. Someone who has spoken to this is Sir Adam Roberts, who made this comment with respect to the fact that many international lawyers simply fail to look at state practice in conflict to understand what the law is all about and how it works and how it does not work. Now, the suggestion was made that battlefield practice only provides details as to violations. I would disagree with that. Article 52, paragraph 2 of Additional Protocol 1 defines military objectives. You have to go to state practice in war to actually see the types of things that governments feel are military objectives, legitimate military objectives in armed conflict. So it's not merely a matter of violations, it's also a matter of what do governments do in interpreting the law to ascertain what it means. Turning to medical aircraft and their protection, over the last 76 years, governments have endeavored to provide protection for medical aircraft through six separate treaties: the 1929 Geneva Wounded and Sick Convention, the 1949 Geneva Wounded, Sick, and Shipwrecked at Sea and Civilians Convention, and 1977 Additional Protocols 1 and 2. Notwithstanding the best efforts of governments and the ICRC to find a workable formula, not one single provision has been employed in combat. Battlefield behavior, using the ICRC term, includes determining whether or not treaty provisions actually work. Ironically, despite the fact that we have had an increased use of medical aircraft for evacuation, as I have pointed out, my historical review has indicated that not one single government has ever relied upon those treaty provisions for protection of its medical aircraft. Notwithstanding that, the ICRC study makes the following comment. Rule 29 makes this statement. Now, that's a good statement for ground transportation. It is not a totally complete statement with regard to protection for medical aircraft. If you look at what is stated in Article 24 of Additional Protocol 1, it says medical aircraft shall be respected and protected subject to the provisions of this part. And the rest of that slide shows you the summary. First, there has to be consent with the opposing party. There has to be a detailed flight plan. I'll talk about that more in just a moment. There must be a response to orders to land. There is an entitlement to inspection. And if a medical aircraft fails to comply with these provisions, it has a loss of protection. It also does not protect search and rescue aircraft. So if you are in the position of advising your client, your commander, on our medical aircraft protection, and you cite only Rule 29, you're somewhat short of the mark. Of course, it was intended as a general rule. The devil's in the details and into other parts, and so I then turn to the commentary itself. It contains seven statements, and what I've done is just go through those very quickly to sort of take you through that and let you see what they say. The first sentence makes this statement. That, again, is a correct statement with regard to ground transport. It is an incomplete statement with regard to medical aircraft. Under the 1949 Geneva Convention and Article 36 of the Wounded and Sick, this is the statement, and actually this is sentence two of the customary law study, but if you look at what the ICRC commentary said that John Pictet wrote in implementation of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, this is a little more restrictive. He emphasizes that medical aircraft are protected only while flying at agreed heights, times, and on route specifically agreed to between the parties of conflict. Protocol 1 is more detailed. There is a requirement, for example, for agreement on flight plans and what have you between the parties of the conflict. There are some exceptions as to where on the battlefield you are, but I'll come back to that in just a moment. Now, flight plans is, in fact, far more detailed than what's stated in the 1949 GWS. This is the ICAO requirements. So this is something that, in essence, where if I am the person requesting for protection from my medical aircraft to fly from point A to point B, and I'm seeking the agreement of the other side in the conflict, he can start with this and he can add any other additional conditions he wishes to. And without that agreement, medical aircraft, except in one particular case I'll come to in just a moment, are not protected while they're flying in those operations. Sentence 3 makes this statement. I think I'm going to go along with what one of my co-panelists said. Military manuals oftentimes simply are straightforward quotes or restatements of what are existing treaty obligations for that government. So the fact that there is a statement in a military manual without further explanation does not necessarily mean that there has been an acknowledgement that it is, in fact, bound other than in its treaty obligations. Certainly, it's not a manifestation of customary international law. Sentence 4 makes this statement. Now, the problem I have with this statement is that it is correct if you're talking about parties to Protocol 1 and you're talking about aircraft operating in contact or similar zones. This statement is not repeated if you're talking about medical aircraft flying in the opposing party's airspace. There is no such provision there. In fact, it's a dilemma. It's a real tension that has gone on between negotiators over the years as to how can we provide protection for medical aircraft, but at the same time respond to concerns we have on with regard to military security. If you look at Article 26, Paragraph 1, this is actually what it says. It does, in fact, say if you're flying in those contact zones, you are protected, and even if you don't have an agreement, but you have been seen to be a medical aircraft, you are entitled to respect during that time. If you do not comply with orders to land and be inspected, of course, you lose that protection. But that same provision does not apply if you're a medical aircraft actually flying in the enemy's airspace. The dilemma is one that Ms. Doswell Beck, in fact, herself has identified in the very excellent article she wrote in 1997. There is this tension, as I mentioned, between governments wishing to use medical aircraft and seeking their protection, but at the same time being very concerned about what the other guy is going to do. I'm sure I would never use my medical aircraft for anything but medical evacuation, but I don't trust you. And this is what governments have wrestled with over the years in trying to find a formula that will work. There are a lot of reasons why they have not worked, and I'll be happy to elaborate on those during the question and answer session, but the main point here is that there are tensions there that are not identified in the ICRC study. The commentary of the ICRC goes on to say, the prohibition on attack of medical aircraft is also set forth in the San Remo Manual on Naval Warfare. Well, that's not exactly what the San Remo Manual said. It does, in fact, provide the very details that I've just identified. They have to be recognized, they have to be acting in compliance with an agreement, they have to fly in areas under the control of owned or friendly forces, and they also are flying outside the armed conflict. And the San Remo Manual does not say that this is customary law. This statement is attributed to the United States. I don't know that we have ever actually said that. I don't have any disagreement with you. The catch here is that the devil's in the details. What is a known medical aircraft? Let me give you an example. Is this a known medical aircraft? Painted white, displaying red crosses. Well, the Royal Air Force did not think it was in 1940 when it was shot down. In fact, several of them were shot down because it was, in fact, a Luftwaffe search and rescue aircraft that actually rescued quite a few Royal Air Force pilots as well, operating in contested areas. It was the opinion of jurists after the war and has been that this was, in fact, a legitimate act by the Royal Air Force in engaging these aircraft and forcing them down. So I point this out to say, how do you know a medical aircraft is a known medical aircraft unless you have, first, an agreement, second, you have ordered it to land, third, you have inspected it, and it returns to and fully complies with that agreement? There are a couple of points here that I think need to be emphasized that unfortunately are missing in the ICRC study. One is the amended annex on signals for identifying medical aircraft makes it very clear that the use of any of those signals, including the display of the Red Cross or the Red Crescent, does not give an aircraft status. It facilitates identification, but it does not give them status. Therefore, if you see an aircraft displaying Red Crosses, that does not make it, as such, a medical aircraft. And as I think someone asked in one of the questions before in the first session with Jean-Marie, this issue of what an aircraft looks like on the outside and what it is doing today is even more important today after September 11, 2001 than it may have been earlier. If you'd ask us on September 11, 2001, would we ever shoot down a civilian airliner, we would say absolutely not. Obviously, a number of governments, including the United States, have had to take a different view of that since that time. This is the last statement. That's probably a true statement. I have no reason to dispute it. The question is, again, what do you know about the medical aircraft? I suspect if it was a known medical aircraft, fully complying, under agreement, and it was attacked, it would be a violation of the law of war. However, let's turn this around. A gentleman whose name was mentioned earlier, who used to teach here with Professor Goldman, Wally Soff, was one of the leading architects of the new regime in Protocol 1 for Protection of Medical Aircraft. Let me read you what he said in an article in 1978. A two-battalion air mobile force has penetrated deep into enemy territory. As a result of a firefight, the force has sustained and inflicted casualties. Two medical evacuation helicopters painted army green with standard-sized Red Cross emblems painted on the nose, side panels, and lower surfaces arrived to evacuate seriously wounded. On the return flight, one helicopter with three enemy and one friendly wounded is shot down by an enemy surface-to-air missile. all aboard are killed in the crash. What war crime, if any, was committed by the enemy in their attacks on the medical aircraft? In response to his own question, Mr. Soff answered, "The answer may be disappointing. Probably no war crime was committed." So I think there are some issues here again as to the details behind each sentence and what they actually represent. Now, again, I want to emphasize here, I've done a little biopsy of one section. I think the ICRC both Ms. Doswell Beck and Jean-Marie have done a superb job of collecting a lot of raw data. I agree with Josh and the others that these are volumes that we will certainly be looking at in so many ways, and I mean that positively. I also agree with something that Josh said that I think is very important for us to recognize the contribution that's been made here. But what I do suggest here is that let the reader beware that obviously you do have 4,500, 5,000 pages of tremendous work, but there's still a lot of detail that is lacking there, and in the ICRC in saying that this is going to be a continuing type of exercise that hopefully much more will be incorporated into it so that many of these details can be placed in there and make this an even more valuable contribution. Thank you very much.
What we're going to do now is to permit the various panelists, the first, if they want to respond to any comments made by other panelists, and then we will open up the floor as we're on schedule for questions. And we'll start how we begin. Louise, would you like to?
Right, thank you. There's so many things said that how much time do I have in order to not, because... Okay, I'll just start. I'll waste more time. Okay, some things are simple to reply to and others require just a little bit of discussion. I'll try to be as short as I can. The first things which are easy, a comment was made that we relied on NGOs and non-state practice to make an evaluation of customary rules. I'm sorry to say that's just simply untrue. It's true that in Volume 2 we have put under the categories of other practice some of this material, but in making the evaluation we rigorously excluded that material as part of the evaluation. So to say that we relied on it is totally untrue. We didn't even use it in the actual evaluation process. It's sitting there for interest's sake, and that's all. The same point I think I would say when the reference was made to reliance on non-binding resolutions. That again is not accurate because every rule that we have found has been a combination of a number of factors, and sometimes indeed resolutions have been part of those factors. We are aware that each resolution is non-binding as such, with the exception, of course, of some Security Council resolutions. But that what we did, like many decisions of the International Court of Justice and other international tribunals, is to see whether there was enough density in the numbers of resolutions adopted by consensus, or by a vote which only excluded, with a negative vote, the state being condemned, which was, for example, Iraq and Yugoslavia, there's a few like this, together with other factors. And as such, therefore, it would be inaccurate to say that we actually relied on resolutions in order to find a rule as such. The next point was the density of practice. I mean, can we infer opinio iuris from sheer density of practice? I'm glad that you put it in a kind of a question mode. Again, all I can say is the fact that we did pay a great deal of careful attention to states not party, their particular practice of states not party to the particular treaties. It became, if we look at the practice of international tribunals, the extent of ratification is taken into account. So that if there's very little ratification, then there's more of a burden to show that there is a lot of practice. I mean, there's plenty of cases that follow this method. So that when we're looking at a practice whereby 160, I don't know how many states now, party to Protocol 1, or even Protocol 2, and then you're looking at, say, the 30-odd states which are not party, it's obvious that the 30-odd states can't make customary law on their own. Otherwise, you'd have customary law not on an almost uniform practice and widespread. It would be on a minority. That wouldn't work. So what we did is to say, well, okay, those who've accepted the rule by binding themselves to it in the form of a treaty is nevertheless practice. But then we look very carefully at the practice of non-states not party or not party at the time when they made that particular declaration statement or whatever. In fact, Jean-Marie and I actually had a negative list. And I have to admit, it became terribly exciting for us to find states which are not on the list, which is very rare, but usually one likes to see states party to things. But this time we were happy to see practice of states not party to something because it was the most important in order to do this evaluation. Quite often, states say neither one thing nor the other. If that's the case, then the question is, well, are they actually specially affected? We've never come across a situation where states say nothing when they're specially affected in the narrow sense, what I mean by, and I'll come to that point as well. But quite often we did use the rule of acquiescence, which is a very normal rule when one is evaluating customary law, that when there is practice in a certain direction, if there is acquiescence and if there's positive practice of states not party, then we behave like other international tribunals. I mean, we're not a tribunal, but we've copied, I would say, the practice of tribunals to say we feel that there's a customary rule that's been developed here. That actually is linked with the more general question that several panelists brought up. What do we mean by specially affected states? How does one take that into account? Very early on in the study, the question was asked in the general consultations, the big consultations with the state representatives there, and also in the steering committee earlier on. Should the practice of the United States be considered more important than others because it is a world power which is frequently involved in armed conflict? I'm sorry to say, but everybody, with the exception of the one person who actually made this question, everybody else said no. Why? Because the overwhelming view, in fact, everybody said that many states are involved in armed conflict. The majority of conflicts around the world are non-international. I mean, what Burundi does in its armed conflict is important. What the Congo says with regard to its armed conflict is important. All states that are involved in armed conflict or can be affected by armed conflict, and that is, I'm sorry to say, a huge number of states around the world these days, are important. And the view also was that one state is more wealthy, more powerful than others, is not relevant in international law. So what is specially affected? We therefore interpreted it. When I say we, I'm talking it with the consultation of the others. In a narrow sense, as is properly interpreted in international law, namely those states which are only capable of doing certain things. And that's not many fall into that category. So, for example, states which have have a coast are more important than states which have no coast when you're looking at the law of the sea, for example. As I mentioned earlier with the San Remo Manual, we basically consulted with states' representatives, which came in their personal capacity, which had significant navies, because that was important. It didn't really matter what landlocked states and those without navies said. So in this case, yes, when it came to the nuclear weapon question, yes, we took it into account. All the views of nuclear weapons, yes, mattered, because only those states which actually have them can say something about that. And in that regard, for example, again on the question of reprisals, well, anybody can do reprisals. Anybody can starve populations. Anybody can attack civilians. That doesn't make anybody specially affected, because anybody can do it. So that's why when we're looking then at how do you look at specially affected states, we limited ourselves to situations where we see it's only states that are capable of doing something, that their practice has to be looked at. And in the case of the environmental protection one, yes, the position of the nuclear powers, insofar as they said something relating to what they thought they are entitled to do with nuclear weapons as such, mattered, which is why I thought, yes, okay, it's important to recognize this and to indicate that those three states which have said that they feel that this rule does not apply to, and two of them have accepted the rule, Great Britain and France, does not apply to nuclear weapons, okay, they're not bound by it, assuming that we agree with the principle of persistent objection. Then the other big question that arose was, surely it can't be that states have refused to ratify Protocol 2, non-international armed conflict, and yet you say this is all customary. I mean, this makes no sense. I've had a lot of experience, as has my colleague Jean-Marie, or ex-colleague, co-author, Jean-Marie, with states who are not happy about restrictions in non-international armed conflicts. And when you talk with them directly, the state representatives, the issue always, without any exception, boils down to the problem of status. If you speak with them about, well, do you think it's a good thing, therefore, and they're definitely okay to torture people, to attack civilians, no, of course not, of course you shouldn't do that, no problem. The anxiety is only status and nothing else. So the actual rules that we've got here, I mean, we've made it very clear that the rule relating to status has not changed. There is no prisoner of war status in non-international armed conflict. That has not changed. But on the basis of a huge amount of practice, including resolution after resolution after resolution, plus many of their own manuals, etc., on behaviors that apply across the board, and in the case of resolutions, which they themselves voted in favor of as well, by the way, we found it hard to say, well, okay, you know, they're not bound by anything. So yes, it may seem surprising, but we felt that on a real evaluation of the actual elements that we see there, that there was enough material to find such rules in non-international armed conflicts. I have to admit that I violently disagree with this question that the Chemical Weapons Convention is a disarmament treaty and had no intention, had no moral background, had nothing to do with humanitarian law. We must remember that the motivation to really get going, I mean, actually get down to the proper negotiation and get a result, occurred after the attack by Iraq on that village, in the Kurdish village, by chemical weapons. That's what led to the motivation to get on with this Chemical Weapons Convention. Let's eliminate them altogether. And the convention, as well, does have a rule against use, including in non-international armed conflicts. And all treaties say that you can withdraw in due course, with the exception of the UN Charter. But okay, I don't think it's such a big deal. And I have to admit, I stick by my reasoning there. But okay, everybody's entitled to a different view. Which brings me to the mercenaries and the aircraft and others. As I have said, and with any of this for that matter, people are entitled to evaluate things differently. But starting on the aircraft, yes, it is a general rule, and Hayes, you're absolutely right that the treaty law is more detailed, and from the point of view of policy, it is very sensible, and that's why a lot of states do it, and so does the ICRC, by the way. It's very sensible to make sure that you have got the consent of the other side, because it's safer. I agree. That's true. And it is detention, yes, I wrote it myself, and you're absolutely right, it is there. The point is that on the material we had available, a lot of these custom rules are, if you like, the minimum basis, like the only generality you can find, and that's all you could do. You couldn't write in more customary stuff that isn't actually there. But yes, it is true that, and this is a point I've really stressed to a lot of people, that this customary law study does not undermine treaty law. Treaty law is still applicable and still must be abided by, especially by by states which are bound by those treaties, they have to abide by treaty law. And often this customary law has more general rules, more basic rules, than treaty law actually requires. And yes, there may be policy reasons, especially why it's a good idea to make sure that you have your aircraft identified properly in advance with the other side in agreement. And yeah, that is true. On the mercenaries issue, The practice as we saw it was a huge amount of acquiescence then, a few years ago, showed that, well, most people seem to agree that provided that, both people states, that provided that you abide by, you look at this really narrow definition, that they're not actually entitled to POW protections. And it's true that since then, because this is really a practice which has become very, very evident in the last few years, we see increasingly a number of private military contractors. Well, let's see what the policy, what the practice becomes with regard to that. In fact, our little center held an expert meeting on that very issue, actually. And I have to admit, now I'm speaking purely personally, not as an author, not as an ICRC person, not as anything. Purely personally, I have to admit, I never really could see that it was such a good idea to have that rule back in Article 47. But one writes an evaluation, not on what one likes, but on what one sees. By the way, I also think spies should get prisoner of war status these days, because I think they help give information, accurate intelligence on what's a military objective, which IHL requires. So, but the rule still is that spies have no POW status, which I think is unreasonable these days. But we wrote what there is, so couldn't change that. Okay, now let me see, is there anything else that's really important? I think that I have covered the most important elements. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for your patience.
Yes, thank you very much, Louise. Josh, do you, would you
no,
like
No, I don't have anything
okay,
to add. I'm
Josh?
Interested in what folks out in the audience have to
okay.
say.
We will go down. Mike?
Well, two brief things. First of all, I don't really think that the practice of the United States, or for that matter, China, Russia, UK, other major military powers, really does have the same weight as the practice of a relatively small country that's not involved in a great deal of military operations, particularly with respect to a field like means and methods of warfare. And I think this is true generally about the development of customary law, that those states which have greater weight in the actual practice, the actual interests in a particular field, their practice does have more significance, which is not to say that the United States is the only party that counts. I'm just saying that it's probably more important than Burundi when it comes to questions of means and methods of warfare. The suggestion was made that the U.S. position is that human rights law does not apply in armed conflict. I can't speak for the U.S. government. If that question had been asked of me when I was in the U.S. government, I would have said, well, no. For each human rights agreement, you have to look and see what it says and whether its particular provisions apply in those particular circumstances. But generally speaking, the rule about the application of human rights law in armed conflict is that articulated by the International Court of Justice in the nuclear weapons opinion. That is to say, human rights principles are not suspended in wartime, but they apply with respect to armed conflict in accordance with the so-called lex specialis, that is the law of armed conflict. So that, for example, the principle about the right to life was applied by the court only in manner consistent with the rules of the of international armed conflict with respect to proportionality and targeting and so on. So that human rights law doesn't disappear, but it is applied. And furthermore, as I think has already pointed out, human rights law can be quite relevant in terms of interpreting provisions of international humanitarian law. For example, when Article 75 says that persons can only be tried and sentenced in accordance with generally acceptable judicial principles, well, obviously, it's quite relevant to see what human rights law has to say in that regard. So, you know, I can't speak for the government, but that's not the answer I would have given.
And just to sort of add to Mike's point, I'm not aware of a new U.S. government position since the time that Mike was my principal deputy.
While it is true that the humanitarian laws treaties have derogation clauses allowing states to withdraw, just as arms control treaties have derogation clauses, those clauses are quite different. The Geneva Conventions and most other law of war treaties specifically say you cannot withdraw from the treaty while you are engaged in an armed conflict, that the treaty continues to apply during the conflict. The arms control treaties, on the other hand, all have these supreme interest clauses that allow you to get out on, simply on notice of your own national judgments. Your supreme interests are jeopardized, and the only qualification is time for the notice.
So I think there is a fundamental juridical distinction between arms control treaties, which is the Chemical Weapons Convention that has a supreme interest clause, and the humanitarian law treaties like the 49 conventions or additional protocol. As to the question of whether customary law can derogate from treaties, I must admit I'm a bit confused. If there is a rule of customary law, as stated in Rule 108, that mercenaries are not entitled to be prisoners of war, as I say, logically that rule must have arisen after 1977. It must be based on state practice by states, all of whom were parties to the 1949 Geneva Conventions, including the Third Convention. So if there is such a rule, it must be based on practice of states that were, in effect, getting out by their practice of an existing treaty obligation.
Okay. I wanted to disagree with Louise on one point, at least. Spies, it has to be tested contextually. What do we mean spy? A spy doesn't lose PW status just because you're engaged in espionage. Even the Quirin case did not deny PW status as they marched them off to trial for a war crime of engaged in combat out of uniform, actually. And there was not quite a ruling on spying in Quirin as such. My point would be, if GPW 4A1 is satisfied, you've got a member of the armed forces of a party to the conflict, they don't lose PW status because of a particular type of activity. That activity might be prosecutable as a war crime, but and espionage is not a war crime per se. In any event, I'm specially affected by this notion of specially affected states. I think it's quite ludicrous when you think about Common Article 1 of the 1949 Geneva Conventions and the history concerning Common Article 1. The recognition that the treaty obligations are obligations not merely among warring parties, but are obligations each to each other. And there's a related concept under customary international law, obligatio erga omnes. Certain obligations are obligations not owing merely to another entity, but are owing to among and by all humankind. And the Geneva Conventions are a prime example of obligatio erga omnes, as well as the prohibition of genocide and a few others. So it seems rather, especially in an increasingly interdependent world, when we're all affected, however indirectly, by warfare. And as Louise pointed out, so many states, unfortunately, have been involved in warfare. It just seems like a especially inappropriate concept or theoretical construct.
Before I open the floor, I just wanted to try to make one comment about something that both Mike and Josh said. In the U.S. position, it's one thing to say that the United States accepts the notion that human rights apply in armed conflict. But from some recently concluded studies, as well as 8 years on the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, the position, and also I think the U.S. reactions to general comments in case law of the Human Rights Committee, has been that human rights law does not apply extraterritorially outside of the territory of the United States, and most particularly it does not apply in situations where there is armed conflict or occupation. These were the views that were expressed essentially by the United States in the Cord case dealing with Grenada. It was, and so it's one thing to state that, yes, they continue to apply, but there has been a consistent, and this is something that is not ideological. It was during the Clinton administration, it was during the Reagan administration, it was during the present administration, that the United States has consistently objected to any use or reference by a human rights treaty body to IHL, and indeed, I would say that the acceptance of the bare statement by the ICJ in the Nuclear Weapons Advisory Opinion they took it to believe that this is the lex specialis, boom, you human rights guys stay out of this, human rights law does not apply. The court clarified what it meant in its most recent decision dealing with the wall, and it was quite clear that what we're talking about is, while it is true that IHL may, in certain circumstances, be the lex specialis, it does not derogate. And there may be situations in which things are exclusively still for human rights law during periods of armed conflict, and alternatively, there may be periods in which the two bodies of law will apply simultaneously, and you may have to have a harmonious interpretation. For example, that was indicated that if you are going to try people, for instance, as unprivileged combatants and so forth and so on, and you are required to have a trial by an independent and impartial court, quite clearly the accepted standard of what are essential judicial guarantees within the meaning, for instance, of Article 75 or a non-international armed conflict are going to be by reference to, for instance, Article 14 of the Covenant. So I think it is somewhat misleading to say we accept the United States that human rights apply during armed conflict. The actual, frankly, things that I have seen in responses to human rights bodies and so forth, as well as in other fora, have been to keep these things pretty much watertight and to say to human rights bodies, you can't deal with this at all, stay out of this and so forth. This is merely the province of the law of armed conflict. With that, we still have some time left. Are there any questions? Please come to the floor. And if you would identify yourself.
Was in the legal division of the ICRC, where from time to time I would give courses or give lectures on introduction to IHL. And one of the things that I brought up often in these situations was to bring out a copy of AP1, bring out a copy of AP2, and show people that one was much thicker than the other, and ask people why they thought that was so. And the correct answer that I was looking for, in one word, it was essentially sovereignty. States are more willing to accept rules in relation to international obligations than to internal ones. Now I'm starting to wonder whether that was the right answer, or maybe it was right, but maybe there's another answer. And the question is whether or not another right answer may be that states are more willing to entertain rules in relationship to a category of armed conflict where the parameters are defined, namely international, which we all know is state A versus state B, as opposed to armed conflict where the parameters are ill-defined. And I wonder if the panelists have views on whether or not states would be more willing to see AP2 become thicker, or maybe more willing to see the development of customary law in the non-international realm become thicker if they had a better ability to distinguish between what is and what is not internal armed conflict, the same way they have a pretty good ability to determine the difference between what is and what is not international armed conflict.
Hayes, and then Mike, and then anyone else on the panel could respond.
I think the part of the answer is historical. Originally, AP1 and AP2 were supposed to be almost mirror images of one another, and at the very last moment, a number of nations, and I don't mean the developed nations, but the least developed nations, gutted it. They did not want those things imposed upon them for conflicts they were fighting within their own borders, but only wanted them imposed upon people invading their borders. I think that's very regrettable. The United States did try to make parallel AP1 and AP2. We have an ongoing discussion right now within the United States government as to whether or not the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq are international armed conflicts or internal conflicts. My answer is it doesn't make any difference. We have a statement in the Department of Defense Law of War Program directive that says the United States will conduct itself in accordance with the law of war regardless of how its military operations are characterized, whether they're peace operations, internal conflict, international armed conflict.
We do that for a couple of reasons. One is all of our doctrine is written with respect to international armed conflict. We have doctrine for how we detain people, how we handle them, how we provide them humane treatment. When you're talking about the individual soldier on the battlefield, we don't want to go out and say, okay, today it's Tuesday, so we're in an internal conflict. Tomorrow, it's Wednesday, we'll be in an international armed conflict. We want to keep the rules simple. From our standpoint, we want to apply a basic template, particularly in attack of military objectives. They don't change. Protection of persons, things like that. So from our point of view, it really should make a difference on the battlefield and actual practice of a government or of its military forces.
Yeah, I'll make a comment.
Yeah, Mike, and then...
Well, yes, I think the reluctance on the part of so many states historically, particularly non-Western states, to accept the full rigor of these protections in internal conflicts does have more fundamental roots than just the thing you suggested. And that includes the fact that these governments are quite reluctant to contemplate the possibility of international intervention into their own conflict situations, which they fear might be the case if detailed rules were applied. They also fear giving status to insurgent groups by recognizing that they have rights, et cetera, et cetera. And we struggled against this in many fora, including, for example, the Conventional Weapons Convention. And it's interesting to look at the Article 1 of that convention, which recites a whole series of things which we had to solemnly pledge in return for the application of these provisions to internal conflicts, including that nothing would affect the legal status of disputed territories or groups, that nothing could be used as a justification for intervention into the territory of states, that nothing would take away from legitimate authority to reestablish law and order. I mean, these were concepts in the minds of a number of governments that they thought would be compromised by the application of rules of armed conflict to internal conflicts. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been such a struggle over the years to try and dispel these ideas.
Yeah, I just want to reinforce the fact that it really is a question of status. I mean, I have got on good authority, which I can't quote directly, that Russia, for example, chose not to derogate from the European Convention on Human Rights because it didn't want to admit that it's got an internal armed conflict in Chechnya. It's absurd. It's got nothing to do with the rules. In fact, it's made itself, therefore, more bound by the strict peacetime rules of human rights applicable to it in Chechnya rather than accept it's got an internal armed conflict formally, which would enable it to derogate to some degree, at least. So it's got nothing to do with the rules. I've seen this in many cases. Same thing with Northern Ireland. I mean, okay, there they derogated, but it's the same thing. It's every single time it's the same thing. It is only status and fear of recognition of the other side, which of course is not true, but it is that's the psychological problem, nothing else.
I wonder, as we think about this too, what derogable human rights, what non-derogable human rights are not already required by Geneva law? It's almost a non-issue, especially if we add norms jus cogens that are increasingly recognized. For example, in general comment number 24 of the committee under the ICCPR.
Other questions? We have a brief amount of time.
You still can't torture. You can't.
Well, I suspect everyone is hungry and also is very anxious to hear our keynote speaker, Judge Theodore Moran. We will therefore adjourn. The luncheon is served on this floor, back to the right, and so forth. There'll be some people outside to help escort you there. And thank you very much. Thank you to the panel.